Yeah, but to the notice of the committee statement, board meeting that will be taken next day, all honourable members agree. All honourable members agree that the committee statement and the first reading of the appropriation bill be taken today?
We now move to adjourn for an act to amend the Supreme Court Act. The Honourable Minister for Education, Justice and International Exchange of Information.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to amend the Supreme Court Act be read a first time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to amend the Supreme Court Act be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Supreme Court Amendment Act 2015.
Speaker, I have the honour to move that the bill be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, this bill makes amendments to the Supreme Court Act so as to set new training requirements for barristers and solicitors who wish to commence practice in Gibraltar as from July 2015. The format and content of these requirements are the result of extensive discussions and agreements between Her Majesty's Government of Gibraltar and the Bar Council, and the Chief Justice was consulted regarding the changes and fully supports the new requirements. That, Mr. Speaker, some of these amendments arise following not just discussion, but calls from the Bar Council for harmonization of training requirements for both barristers and solicitors. The current system, Mr. Speaker, is that whilst barristers are able to be admitted and enrolled as barristers of the Supreme Court under the Supreme Court Act upon completion of the Bar Professional Training Course, solicitors are nevertheless required to undertake a further 2-year training period after completing the common professional examination before they can be admitted and enrolled as solicitors of the Supreme Court. In addition, solicitors and not barristers are required to undertake a professional skills course before admission. Mr. Speaker, given the few professional individuals whereby barristers and solicitors essentially undertake the same type of work and have the same rights of audience in our court, both the Majesty's Government of Gibraltar and the Bar Council says that the current disparity between the training requirements for barristers and solicitors could no longer be justified. In fact, Mr. Speaker, what was happening was that barristers, upon completion of their training, could come back to Gibraltar, be enrolled immediately as barristers of the Supreme Court, and undertake solicitor work, given that we have a few professionals. Whereas solicitors who did the professional training still had to do 2 more years before being able to be enrolled as a solicitor of the Supreme Court. And that was an anomaly which we couldn't allow to stand any longer. And in addition to that, Mr. Speaker, local law firms that were previously approved by the Law Society of Training Establishments authorized to undertake the 2-year training period for solicitors were having difficulty in renewing their approval. This meant that it would be very difficult, if not impossible, for those who qualify as solicitors to carry out their training in Gibraltar. The new requirements which are given effect by the bill, which amends the Supreme Court Act, will apply to both barristers and solicitors equally and include the following elements. 1, an academic course in Gibraltar law. 2, practical training over 1 year in an approved establishment in Gibraltar. And 3, a professional skills course. Mr. Speaker, the academic course in Gibraltar law will be delivered by the University of Gibraltar as from September 2015. It will involve 24 lectures over the academic year. The lectures will be presented by members of the Gibraltar Bar with a particular interest and expertise in the areas of law covered, and in the case of lectures on accounting for lawyers, by a local accountant. The practical training element, Mr. Speaker, will require barristers and solicitors to undertake a 1-year training contract at an approved establishment. The minimum criteria for approval as a training establishment will be a Gibraltar firm that contains at least 3 practitioners, 1 with at least 10 years standing and 2 with at least 7 years standing. Provided, Mr. Speaker, in the bill is that the Chief Justice may, in exceptional circumstances, approve an establishment which does not meet these criteria and may set other conditions. And this training, Mr. Speaker, will cover at least three of the following four areas of legal practice: commercial law, property law, litigation, and private crime. The professional skills course is expected to be undertaken toward the end of the year's training and will include advocacy and communication skills, client care and professional standards, and financial and business skills. The new requirement, as the current practice, may be waived by the Chief Justice or outside counsel wishing to be admitted to the Gibraltar Bar for a particular case. In addition, the Chief Justice would have the discretion to waive the requirements of the practical training and professional skills course, but not the academic qualification in Gibraltar law. For any barrister or solicitor wishing to practice in Gibraltar, if he was satisfied that such barrister or solicitor already had the necessary training or experience. Furthermore, this program also contains provisions amending sections 34 and 35 of the Supreme Court Act, which are not directly related to the new training requirements. The amendment to section 34 corrects a typographical error in the paragraphing of section 3, and the amendment to section 35 updates the offence of unqualified persons practicing in Gibraltar, so that a person not enrolled as a barrister or solicitor in Gibraltar who exercises or holds himself out of to exercise the right of ordinance before any legal support, or carries on or holds himself out to carry on any activity which, under any enactment, is restricted to barristers or solicitors or both, or provides or holds himself out as able to provide or reward legal services of any description in or somewhere in Gibraltar to members of the public or businesses generally. If such a person would be guilty of an offence and is liable on summary conviction to a fine at level 5 on the standard scale. Mr. Speaker, I want to give notice of an amendment I am proposing to make, a minor amendment, which has just arisen, and which I propose to make at committee, and that is to clause 1 in the title on commencement. Clause 1 provides that the Act will come into operation on the 1st of July 2015. There are currently, Mr. Speaker, a number of petitions for calls to the bar before the Gibraltar Court. I understand and I expect that all those petitions will be heard and be decided on before the 1st of July. But what we want to do is simply make an amendment to this to allow a little bit of flexibility in case there is any slippage of 2 or 3 days. We wouldn't want an act which comes into operation on the 1st of July to interfere with petitions which are already and currently before the Supreme Court, if they are already being dealt with, as I understand they are. So therefore, I will be proposing that should be amended to a day appointed by the government by notice of the Gazette with different days according to different purposes, which is the standard day that we use. And if there is slippage, the intention is still that the bill be, or the act be commenced on the 1st of July. But if there is a 1 or 2 day slippage, then we have that flexibility so as not to interfere with pending cases before the Supreme Court. Since I commend the bill to the House.
All right, put the question. There's any honourable member who should speak on the general principles and merits of the bill?
Yes, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to say that this side of the House will be supporting the bill. I'm mostly really to reminisce of how it used to be, certainly. I remember during the prior year knowing that we had the advantage that we did over our own counterparts in the training, which we've also qualified as barristers, and knowing that we would be enrolled and admitted immediately and that we'd be able to start practicing from the moment we arrived in Gibraltar. The experience, Mr. Speaker, of doing that and not having the training that this bill contemplates introducing was one of much stabbing in the dark, if I'm honest, and I was a profound. Which not sure whether it was stabbing in the dark or less by any means. But there was obviously no formal training, and that was the rule of the day, and everybody kind of got on and hoped and prayed that they were going to pick it up along the way. It was only really down to the generous giving of time of some of the practitioners, many actually in most cases, in the firm, that we were able to find our way through the minefield. Because of course, we'd return from the UK with much fresh in our minds that we probably had to disregard to learn something new, particularly in the company context where our bill was from the English 1929 Act, and that's certainly not what we have been taught in the UK. So I certainly welcome this. I understand as well that concerns that have been raised by relevant bodies have been addressed. In relation to the academic course, I've had the opportunity of discussing with the Honourable Minister what that course might entail and the practitioners that might be tasked with providing it. And I have to say, it is exciting, certainly from this side of the house, as I assure it is from there. The fact that, you know, the training requirements will be equalised between barristers and solicitors is probably going to be of benefit to the profession, because, of course, as we all know, so much of our work is solicitor style work, that it seems only right that the training requirements should be equalised. And that will likely have the effect that more people choose not to don a wig during their special training in the UK and return probably a little better prepared for the style of practice that is prevalent in this jurisdiction. This side of the House has no problem with the amendment proposed by the Honourable Minister, and I look forward to seeing how the training develops and learning of its delivery in the New York Delegate.
Thank you.
Mr. Speaker, we're grateful for the support of the other side of the House and the words of the Honourable Member. These new requirements, which, as I mentioned, have been the subject of consultation and agreement with the Bar Council and consultation also with the Chief Justice, have generally been, or rather have been universally accepted and received with glee by all members of the profession, certainly everyone that I have spoken to, and I am aware. Members of the profession, that's what I say, by all members of the profession. The Honourable Member has mentioned the concerns were raised by relevant bodies. In fact, no concerns have been raised, certainly to me, by any member of the profession. There was some correspondence by a group of students who were now going to be able to be required to comply with the requirements. And to that correspondence, separate and individual replies were given by myself, by the Chief Justice, and by the Minister as chairman of the Bar Council. So we each addressed all those issues, and we haven't heard any further, and therefore I hope that they are satisfied with the responses that they have received. As the Honourable Member has mentioned, the system we had is that the terms of devotee called to the bar, and in some cases thrown at the deep end with no formal practical training. But that in itself wasn't so much a problem, but the anomaly of solicitors having to do the 2 years and barristers having to do no practical training at all when they were both doing the same job, and in particular barristers doing the work of solicitors, that was something that needed to be corrected. And what we have done is reduce the time the solicitors have to do from 2 years, as they are required to do in the UK, to 1 year, and increase what barristers have to do from nothing to 1 year. So it's a compromise, but it harmonizes and also adds the new and exciting prospect of a brand new academic requirement into data law, which has never existed. And I would add, Mr. Speaker, just to end, that this new academic course, although it's a requirement for those who want to practice and be called to the bar, it will in fact be open to everyone. Whether you work in financial services, in banking, in gaming, or anywhere else, and you want to have an oversight of what the data law is about in any field, then that is something that anyone can enroll. I would commend it to the Honourable Member. We will be very happy to see him at the University of St. September.
I now put the question, which is the bill for an act to amend the Supreme Act, the Supreme Court Act, you heard a second time. Are you in favour? That's against. Carried. The Supreme Court Amendment Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill to be taken today if all Honourable Members agree.
All Honourable Members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today.
a bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission, encourage purchasers to comply with consumer law and improve their trading practices. Renew and simplify the trade licensing system and remain the modernized system of business licensing. Establish enforcement powers for the business licensing authority, be part of the Office of Fair Trading in case of non-appearance by licensees. Establish a single point of contact as part of the business licensing procedure. Amend the law to the protection of the collective interest of consumers. Enable action to be taken against conduct which may significantly harm the interest of consumers and for connected purposes thereof. The Honourable the Minister for Business and Employment.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission, encourage businesses to comply with consumer law and improve the trading practices, streamline and simplify the trade licensing system, and rename the modernized system as business licensing, establish enforcement powers for the business licensing authority being part of the Office of Fair Trading in cases of non-adherence by licensees. Establish a single point of contact as part of the business licensing procedure, amend the law relating to the protection of the collective interests of consumers, enable action to be taken against conduct which may significantly harm the interests of consumers, and for the purposes connected therewith to be read a first time. So we have the speech action.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission, encourage businesses to comply with consumer law and improve their trading practices, streamline and simplify the trade licensing system, and rename the modernized system as business licensing, establish enforcement powers for the business licensing authority being part of the Office of Fair Trading in cases of non-adherence by licensees, establish a single point of contact as part of the business licensing procedure, amend the law relating to the protection of the collective interests of consumers, enable action to be taken against conduct which may significantly harm the interests of consumers, and for purposes connected therewith be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
Fair Trading Act 2015. Mr. Speaker, I move that the Fair Trading Bill be read a second time. It is both a pleasure and a privilege to have the opportunity to present to Parliament what I am sure this House will agree is a project that will, amongst other things, take that leap in easing the administrative burdens of establishing a business in Gibraltar. The Fair Trading Bill and the establishment of an Office of Fair Trading in Gibraltar have been in the bookmaking for the better part of 3 years due to the depth of our research and consultation. Mr. Speaker, with your indulgence, I will abbreviate the Office of Fair Trading to OFT during the course of the speech. As some members of the House are already aware, the OFT is a statutory regulator set up by the Majesty Government of Gibraltar as a watchdog to protect consumer interests and ensure that a fair marketplace is adhered to by all businesses. It will study the market, issue information and educational guidance, enforce consumer protection law, prohibit practices that significantly harm consumer interests, and simplify the licensing regime. Mr. Speaker, I must at the outset thank the Honourable Member opposite, Mr. Damon Bosnia MP, for reading the bill and for very useful suggestions, most of which I am sure he will be pleased to learn have been incorporated in the bill. Mr. Speaker, for the most part, our differences are highlighted in the public and not our agreements or collaborations. I therefore wish to highlight that members of this Parliament can and do in fact work together, and in this instance, our joint endeavour is to draft better law which can only be of benefit to our community. Mr. Speaker, leaving aside my gap for bipartisanship, I should note that on the 18th of March of this year, our officer, the Department of Business and Employment, held an open seminar on the OFT. It is clearly the collective opinion of the participants that the bill should commence as soon as practicable, and that the introduction of best practice guidance should not be introduced soon enough. The general consensus, after all the research and feedback received, following three elements would be essential for the success of the OSP. One, licensing, which is currently at the state, regulation, which is not fully in place, and enforcement, which is not currently in place. The purpose of the speaker is to set out how the bill, when put together, will form the legal premise from which the authors are achieved linked, standing proudly at the forefront of the government's regulatory revolution for consumers and businesses alike. Part 2, Mr. Speaker, establishes the Office of Fair Trading, as well as its duties and functions. At the end of each financial year, Clause 4 requires that the OFT assess its performance and any relevant developments throughout the year, as well as the extent to which it has met its main objectives in the form of an annual report which must be laid before this House. The OFT has a duty to obtain and provide information to the public as to its functions and consumer protection measures. It is envisaged that the OFT will be active in its informative role and will engage the public by publishing educational materials and carrying out educational activities. The OFT will review commercial activities that relate to goods or services supplied or offered to consumers in Gibraltar, in order to become aware of any practices that could significantly harm the interests of consumers. The OFT is not there merely to act as an after-the-event type complaints handler. It will be active and forward-looking in its approach and engage with the general public. It will strive to improve potential for growth in an environment that is well-regulated, neutral and fair for all involved. In this spirit, the OFT is granted a power under Clause 7 to formulate proposals as to any aspect of the law or proposed changes. The OFT Commission, known in the Bill of the Commission, is the quasi-judicial body of the OFT established by Clause 10. It is responsible for implementing decisions, upholding consumer law, and hearing referrals from the OFT alleging that a person or business has significantly harmed consumer interest. The Commission does not initiate inquiries and dependency. All of its activities are undertaken following a reference to it by the OFT or a minister. On issues of law, the Commission has the power to refer a case for the opinion of the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeal of the Bill. In this respect, the rules of the Supreme Court apply to the Commission in the same way as it would apply to the Magistrate Court. Part 4 of the Bill allows the complaints to be made to the OFT, either by individual or designated consumer bodies. Designated consumer bodies are appointed by the Minister and published in the Gazette. Consumers may not always have the knowledge or information necessary to judge whether markets are failing them, known as information asymmetry. The bill therefore allows for designated consumer bodies to make a super complaint for OFT, where they consider that a feature or a combination of features of a market for goods or services is significantly harming consumer interest. In that way, the designated bodies on behalf of consumers refer the matter to the OFT. They are a fast track to ensure that these complaints are considered within a shorter time period, being 90 days from the receipt of all information relating to the complaint. By virtue of Clause 19, a consumer or a business may also make a complaint to the OFT. The ability for businesses to also be able to make a complaint is important. For this reason, the definition of consumer in the bill includes persons who are acting for the purposes which are wholly or mainly outside of the business. For example, goods bought by individuals primarily for their own personal needs, but also for the businesses are also afforded protection under the bill. If the OFT has reasonable grounds for suspecting that any feature or combination of features of a market in Gibraltar for goods or services is or appears to be significantly harming consumer interest, you may refer the matter in accordance with Clause 20 to the Commission for review. The Minister may also make a reference to the Commission where he is not satisfied with a decision of the OFT not to make a reference, or where the Minister has brought information to the OFT's attention that he is not satisfied, or he is not satisfied, that the OFT will decide to make a reference. The content to be included in references to the Commission, such as the place where the good or services are supplied or acquired, or the person by or to whom they are supplied, are more particularly set out in the bill. Before the OFT makes a reference, it will use its best endeavours to communicate with that person and obtain from them an assurance in the form of an undertaking. An undertaking is a satisfactory written assurance given by the person concerned that they will refrain from behaving in the manner described as being significantly harmful to consumer interests. The undertaking may be extended to an individual who is going through such behavior or by a body corporate, whether the director, manager, or similar officer, or has a controlling interest in the company. The OSU can investigate and ask the relevant business to give evidence under Clause 24 to help decide whether a reference is necessary. An undertaking in lieu of reference will come into force when accepted by the OSU. It may be varied or suspended by another undertaking or may be released by the OSU. No reference will be made in relation to any feature or combination of features of a market if A, the OSU has accepted an undertaking within the previous 12 months, and B, the goods or services fall within the same description as the goods or services described in the reference. This is not proper reference being made to the Commission, however, if the OSU considers that an undertaking has been breached. A reference may still be made where the person giving an undertaking supplies false or misleading information to the OSU. Mr. Speaker, one of the main criticisms of the UK OSU model was that it failed to actively identify risks of malpractice, instead relying on complaints from consumers and information from other third parties. And it is for this reason that the Water Fair Trading Bill has introduced state-level consumer protection officers. The simply enforcer's primary role is to protect the collective interests of consumers and ensure a level playing field for all businesses. The enforcers will be required to monitor and check advertisements for accuracy, visit businesses to review the practices and inspect weighing and measuring equipment used for businesses, inspect and test goods for safety, check licenses to ensure they are in place and up to date, ensure that no person is selling goods to consumers without a license, and act and investigate conduct that could appear to harm consumer interests. In order to provide and impose effective deterrence, the OSU must be active on enforcement. If a business has conducted itself in a way that could be significantly harmful to consumers, the OSU will consult such business to try and remedy the harmful conduct at an early stage. If this fails, the Commission will become involved. An enforcement order issued by the Commission would name the suspected person who has engaged in conduct that significantly harms consumer interests. It will direct the person to comply with the content of the order sometime within a specified time period. Businesses, Mr. Speaker, need not fear the law, however. The OSU will, as soon as is reasonably possible after the date of assent, prepare and publish advice and information explaining the provisions relating to CPE enforcers and indicating how the OSU expects such provisions to operate. At both venues held this year, such explanations and guidance were put forward and discussed with the attendees. Any person aggrieved by a decision of the OSU, the Minister or the Commission, in connection with the reference, may appeal to the Supreme Court, but an appeal may only be brought on a question of law, as an appeal must be made within 28 days of the Commission's decision. Mr. Speaker, Part 9 deals with business licensing and is therefore an important and central component of the Bill. The Trade Licensing Act 1978 will be repealed upon implementation of the Fair Trading Act, which makes the way for a modern and streamlined business licensing procedures. In line with the improvements of the licensing regime, we have replaced the term trade license with their modern equivalent, a business license. Mr. Speaker, the revised licensing provisions are forward-thinking and in line with European Union requirements. A prime example of this is the new statutory presumption that an applicant will be able to carry on business in Gibraltar subject to obtaining the required license. There is also a presumption that a license will be renewed subject to there being no breaches of the terms of the license having taken place. Trade licenses previously run in calendar years from the 1st of January to the 31st of December. Under the bill, a license will continue in force for 1 year from the date of its issue and will thereupon expire. The OSU, Mr. Speaker, will cover a wider reach of businesses and services to avoid incidents of unlicensed malpractice. From feedback received from the industry, those who did abide by the existing regulatory regime often fell cheaper by those who are able to avoid regulation by selling goods or providing services without a license. Gibraltar needs to ensure a fair playing field, not just for the benefit of consumers, but equally as importantly for businesses as well. The ability to license sellers of goods is invaluable as a consumer protection tool. Licenses do not only cover trade, but also services of any kind not already catered for under existing legislation. In other words, all businesses and services not regulated under Gibraltar legislation are caught by the bill. As the law currently stands, a license can only relate to a single property. Under the bill, however, the licensing authority has a discretion to allow more than one license over a single premises. To do so, the authority will need to be satisfied that the existing license can coexist in a compatible manner with a license to carry on business of a different type at the same premises. Further, Mr. Speaker, as a vitally important step forward, the requirement to have premises may be waived entirely in cases where the licensing authority is of the opinion that such businesses do not need premises in which to operate, such as, but not limited to, online services. To protect the OSP's position, a person who knowingly gives any false information when applying, or with regard to an application to object, will face a fine of up to level 3 on the standard scale. Previously, Mr. Speaker, there was no administrative procedure for a license to extend the license, which led to existing license holders making manuscript amendments to a new application. The new act corrects this. In order to encourage productivity and enterprise in Gibraltar, provisional licenses may be granted to startups. The precondition for such a provisional license is that the applicant has premises that are being or will be constructed for the purposes of being used for a business in Gibraltar. Provisional licenses may also be granted where premises are being altered for the purpose. The provisional license will only be granted on the condition that such premises are fit for use within 12 months from the date of issue of the provisional license, following which the provisional license automatically expires. The new bill, Mr. Speaker, removes the statutory discretion to refuse a license on the basis that the needs of the community in Gibraltar or in the area where the trade or business is to be carried on are adequately provided for. This removal reduces the risk of monopoly and provides consumers with a greater variety of competitively priced goods and services in accordance with Directive 2016-123-EC on the services in the internal market. In the spirit as well of the EU Services Directive, Member States should facilitate the establishment of productivity in business. As a result, in addition to the reduced grounds under which a person may lodge an objection, the bill also introduces a filing fee payable upon the lodging of any objection. Business license hearings, Mr. Speaker, were previously held on an ad hoc basis, usually once a month. These meetings must now be held at a minimum of fortnightly intervals, and whereas the previous state licensing meetings were called to consider all applications, the Business Licensing Authority will only call for a hearing if either the following circumstances are met. One, that it is deemed necessary for the purpose of considering the applications, or where an objection has been received. Mr. Speaker, it is imperative that the licensing hearings are carried out in an objective and impartial manner, and for this reason, any person who has a disqualifying interest in the matter being heard, being for reasons of financial interest, having an interest in a competing business, organizational relationships, or personal relationships, will be prohibited from considering the application, which allows the authority to alert itself to potential risk of conflict at all times. Mr. Speaker, also an important modernization and overhaul of the current system, the concept of business licensing will be revolutionized by the introduction of an online area for information, forms, payments, and advice in relation to business licensing. increasingly, Mr. Speaker, daily tasks are carried out online, and this government is steadfastly committed to introducing the legislative and logistical structure to accommodate the digital era. The information that a government places in the public domain forms a crucial part of our engagement with the general public. The introduction, therefore, of an online information portal and the new online business licensing system will steer us towards the technologically modern way we intend to conduct our business. In line with the EU Services Directive, Mr. Speaker, there will also be an office within the OST known as the Single Point of Contact. The Single Point of Contact aims to drastically ease an applicant's administrative burden. This will become the first port, of course, for new businesses and intend to set up a portal. The Single Point of Contact is a convenient one-stop shop providing information and guidance on the various licensing and registration requirements historically handled by a multitude of government departments. An applicant will be able to collect and complete the forms at a single point of contact. Whereas previously forms had to be delivered to several different locations, the single point of contact will also accept completed forms and redistribute them. It sets out that these forms may relate to a business license, town planning permit, environmental health permit, registration as a business trade or profession, and registration for tax and social insurance. The single point of contact provides applicants with all information and procedural formalities by electronic means, so that these can be accessed and completed remotely as well as manually. The facility will also include the provisions to help and support electronically and or by telephone for its users in accordance with Clause 98. Mr. Speaker, Schedule 3 of the bill is divided into two clearly distinct parts, both of which cover areas that require a license under the bill. Further, any category whose business involves handling client money or holding financial deposits for clients will be required to evidence the OST that the business has put in place a separate client account within 3 months from the date of issue of the license. The Minister has the power to issue code of conduct or consumer code with guidance for certain categories of license holders to follow under practice. The code, which we are to publish in conjunction with the opening of the OST, are comprised of a consumer code for estate agents, a consumer code for travel agents, and a consumer code for all those licensed businesses that require a client account under the bill. Mr. Speaker, to conclude, the government has worked earnestly to bring into fruition the legislative provisions of the Fair Trading Bill in a way that is capable of being read by the non-legal person and avoids legal jargon. By simplicity, the legislation marks the passage of the people and consumer protection currently found in our law and ushers in a modern and unified era of consumer protection, complaint redress, and enforcement. We also ensure a fair level playing field for businesses by mandating that all businesses play by the same rules and that no one endures an unfair advantage. Further, in the spirit of the European Union Digital Single Market, Gibraltar is taking bold steps to create an open and flexible market within the supervisory and regulatory framework established by the OST. Our outdated trade licensing legislation and lack of consumer enforcement powers do not match our aspirations for economic growth. Gibraltar, Mr. Speaker, must strive to maintain choice in our market and allow for new businesses to flourish. We aim to give applicants access to services at a single point of contact without having to resort to paper-based processes delivered throughout Gibraltar. By digitizing information services and allowing consumers to submit applications for business licenses online, businesses will be able to establish themselves much more efficiently. I believe that this legislation caters to the dynamic nature of the digital economy in which we live. I also firmly believe that the new streamlined application system and single point of contact will be an effective way to bring better years and business to Gibraltar. Making life simpler makes doing business a more user-friendly experience for those involved and provides consumers with better choice. After all, Mr. Speaker, the less time that business people spend lodging applications, the more time they will have to dedicate to their businesses. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put a question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the very principles and merits of this bill?
Mr. Speaker, yes. I just thank the honourable minister for his for the recognition of the work done by the opposition. I'm grateful for that. And he knows that this side of the House will be supporting the bill. He heard me yesterday during the course of my intervention in relation to the appropriation bill. So, going into the meat of things, Mr. Speaker, just to raise a few points which arise from my further very quick review of the second incarnation of the bill. And I would refer him to, and we could take a note, and perhaps in his reply later on, I give an explanation or assistance in relation to the words in clause 10, something like this, 10-2, and it means the function of the commission is to ensure a level playing field between businesses for the benefit of consumers and the economy. I think you may recall that in the course of our discussion, and this is one of the clauses which have survived in the new bill. During the course of our discussions, I think I mentioned that I found some difficulty with those words, because I know that the intention has been, he told me throughout, that the wording should be as non-legal as possible. But I think certainly in my mind, in many respects, has given rise to more complications than less. And perhaps you can give some explanation as to whether there's any case law or any form of guidance as to what that will mean in practice and legally. Moving on, Mr. Speaker, I'm glad to see in clause 20 the removal of some of the tests which were reflected in the wording used in relation to references to the commission. I think it was very confusing in the first draft of the bill, where it referred to preventing restrictions distorting good consumer practices for trading. I think that has now been changed. If the House bears with me, significantly harming consumer interest. And perhaps if he could confirm in his reply that is the uniform test which applies irrespective of the matter that is being addressed in the particular clause in the bill, whether it's a reference to the OST Commission, a reference to the Commission or any other use. I think the test is now standard. And the test now is significantly harming consumer interest. But I'd be grateful for his confirmation in relation to that. Okay, moving along. Again, from a quick review of the bill, I see that the erroneous references, cross references to the previous clauses have also been addressed, which is very useful indeed. Mr. Speaker, if I could ask the Minister to take a note of this particular clause, it's clause 28, 5B, this is double check, but it is still there in the new Act. I think it was when I saw it. Well, it reads, for the purposes of this part, a benefit is a consumer benefit, I'll ignore A. Yes, so it would be, for the purposes of this part, a benefit is a consumer benefit. Then you've got A, which is a benefit to consumers, blah, blah. And then B, okay, the Commission believes that. I'm not sure the wording quite flows as nicely as it should, though, because I think A and B ought to be read disjunctively. So you read the first bit, for the purpose of this part, a benefit is a consumer benefit, and then it goes on, the Commission believes. I think there may be something missing there. And then if you could give an explanation of B1-2, which I don't think yes survives, where it says yes of course.
Mr. Speaker, just on that point, if I am following the honourable gentleman correctly, I am referring to section 28 subsection 5. What it reads, for the purposes of this part, a benefit is a consumer benefit. A, if it is a benefit to consumers or future consumers in the form of, and has paragraph 1-2, and the Commission believes.
Yes,
is absolutely right.
That clarifies completely the point that I was making. But in any event, B1C, I don't necessarily need to read the entirety of that clause, but I thought when I first read it, Mr. Speaker, that the wording was rather woolly. I didn't quite understand it. Maybe if he could specifically hone in and focus on that particular section and provide the House with some explanation for its current existence in the bill in its current form.
Clause 74,
again, very happy to see the drastic tidying up that we see there, because I think in the original draft of the bill, I think we had erroneous references. I see that Ms. Miles is her assistant. The Ministry in relation to government is nodding ahead. But I think it was very specific to the death of a license holder, and it's now being made much wider. And I think, as it currently stands, Mr. Speaker, it now works. It now very definitely works, and it makes it much more user friendly. Just a final point, Mr. Speaker. Perhaps this is a point I could have raised in the committee stage. But in Schedule 2.5, this is a point. Yes, probably more federally can be raised, but I just haven't given him notice. And maybe it's an amendment that he could himself suggest. If it's Schedule 3.5 to be precise. And it reads, the chairman of the commission may be removed from office only for inability to discharge the functions of his office, I'll forget the bracket, or for misbehavior, and shall not be removed except in accordance with subparagraph 5. And so it's not clear which subparagraph 5 is it referring to. Is it that paragraph, is it that subparagraph itself? And maybe to simply read in accordance with this paragraph or this subparagraph, just a suggested word, and right? It may be a bit of a nonsense as it currently stands. Oh, I think you're so fine. I think that's the end. Mr. Speaker, I'm going to.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I'm grateful for the opportunity to contribute to this debate. Mr. Speaker, I would ask a specific question in relation to Schedule 3 and the business license in Castle, and in particular to Clause B6, which is drafted as online services provided from the broker. But I think I've not given notice to the Honourable Member because I've not actually listed until today. And I would just it's not my area of responsibility, so pardon me, that's fatal. I'm very happy that I've decided that I'd make the comment that I'll declare just in case, because I think Alan wants it, that a potential interest, because it is equal as the firm for which I work, that has drafted this. So I just put that out there, so if you're aware of it before I raise the point, because it's not a point in any way.
I would like to attend for 2015 because I can see that the longer I stand, the longer I retire, Mr. Speaker. And I also want to add a point to both of you, Mr. Speaker. I see a very wide and capturing all online services. Now, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Member may or may not be aware that there are websites out there that are special interest blogs, special interest web publishing, where the income from which website is purely affiliate marketing commissions based, and therefore it isn't a service as such. And I wondered when I saw it, given my particular interest in that kind of activity in any of them, that whether it might be possible perhaps to suggest an amendment that might exclude that kind of business. And again, I appreciate the lateness of the notice, but it may be something to think about at this stage. That, because, Mr. Speaker, you see, that's the kind of activity where many entrepreneurs might start out in online business as such. They may be writing about a subject that they're interested in, and they may be able to generate some income as a result of the very easy availability of online affiliate marketing initiatives. And I would suggest, Mr. Speaker, and it's something for the Honourable Members to consider, whether perhaps we might be able to exclude services other than special interest web publishing where the income arises exclusively from affiliate marketing commission. Again, I leave it to the Honourable Member to consider. I've drafted a potential amendment to that clause, and would move it if you consider it relevant. In fact, if you would like to have a quick word about it behind the speaker's chair, if that's appropriate, Mr. Speaker, then I'm more than happy to do that too.
Mr. Speaker, I'll take first the Honourable Mr. Vestino's questions to me. In first case, he asked me about the reason why at section 10, or clause 10, subclause 2, is specific reference to level playing field. And I think that I've explained during the course of my speaking, my discussions with him over the phone and in my office, that the main thrust of the Office of Fair Trade and Bill, actually, interestingly, was not so much from consumers, but from businesses. It is the legitimate complaints and gripes of licensed businesses who claim fairly by rules and by certain codes of conduct that there were other players within the Gibraltar market who were not playing by the same rules or by the same conduct. And therefore, whereas there is no case law because that part of the bill is specifically from us, drafted by us, I do not think that it would be a difficult point on which the Supreme Court will be able to adjudicate for that simple reason, and for the reason that the schedule, I believe it was Schedule 3, sets out all of the businesses that are to be licensed by the statute. But in the body of the bill, it also says that the licenses to be issued by the Business Licensing Authority are for those businesses which aren't already caught or covered by other legislation, financial services legislation, the Supreme Court Act, the Biases and Solicitors. So we are talking by exclusion of a set of businesses not already covered. And therefore, the Supreme Court, I think, will have a very easy time to be able to determine whether the business falls under Schedule 3, whether it's a business that needs to be licensed as a result of that schedule, and because it's not covered by any other enactment. And therefore, all that the phrase does is ensure that everyone who's not already covered and should be covered is covered, so that no business gets away with not playing by the same rules. In terms of consumer interest, it is absolutely right when he says that the consumer interest test is the standard test throughout the entirety of the bill. And in respect of the mismatch of cross references, as the Honourable Gentleman knows, and as I explained, because of the numerous number of drafts, there were certain sections which did not correctly cross reference to others, and I'm grateful to him, as I told him in my vice president draft speech, but I'm grateful to him for pointing that out to me. In respect to the Honourable Mr. McGarry, in the first place, to remark about his preface to the question that was raised on Wednesday in this house, and secondly, that if we were to at the risk of asking the Honourable Chief Minister, who's already alerted me to the fact that he does not like this level of bipartisanship, if he puts to me a proposed amendment, I'll be more than happy to consider it by the time we get to the committee stage.
Good work.
Just before I said that, unless I miss it, there's one point which I think is left out, which is an explanation in relation to the wording in 28.5. Did I miss that? And also, it just occurred to me when he was speaking about the homegrown wording in relation to level playing field. I think in his discussion, he told me that there was some EU directive influence in relation to it. Is that correct? No? Do you remember when we discussed that, is it a natural feature on the first pages of the bill? And yes, Mr. Speaker, my discussions with the Honourable Gentleman, or they're not stirred in my mind and having been unpleasant, I do remember what we spoke, and the EU Services Directive comes in the point that I pointed out in the speech, which are essentially the single point of contact, and also making sure that the ground that said that we couldn't set up a business if that particular area of water was already catered for had to be abolished because it was deemed to be anti-competitive. And the in the text of section 28.5 as subparagraph B, 2, the Commission will always have to carry out a balancing exercise, and there will be occasions where a particular market feature concerns us has good aspects and bad aspects. And therefore the Commission will have to determine whether the good outweighs the bad.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission, encourage businesses to comply with consumer law and improve their trading practices, streamline and simplify the trade licensing system, engineering the modernized system of business licensing, establish enforcement powers for the business license authority, being part of the Office of Fair Trading in cases of non-adherence by licensees, establish a single point of contact as part of the business licensing procedure, amend the law relating to the protection of the collective interests of consumers, enable action to be taken against conduct which may significantly harm the interests of consumers, and for purposes connected therewith be read a second time. Those in favour? Goes against, carried. The Fair Trading Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to give notice that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Do all honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today?
Bill for an Act to amend the Gibraltar Land Title Act 2011, the Honourable the Deputy Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have rise to move that a bill for an Act to amend the Gibraltar Land Title Act 2011 be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an Act to amend the Gibraltar Land Title Act 2011 be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against?
The Gibraltar Land Titles Amendment Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I'd be honest to know that a bill for an act to amend the Gibraltar Land Titles Act 2011 be read a second time. In accordance with the manifesto commitment listed in page 19, this bill makes various amendments to the Gibraltar Land Titles Act 2011 to address concerns of legal participants with respect to registration of deeds. When the Act was commenced, together with the accompanying regulations, it introduced significant procedural changes with the aim of tightening up the regime of registration of deeds. Many lending institutions complained about the inordinate amount of time it took them to retrieve registered deeds
post completion from some legal practitioners. Registered deeds provide security to a lending institution against a loan or mortgage that is given out, and it is understandable that the said institutions would want them to invest their keepings immediately after. In order to rectify the situation and the low fear felt by lending institutions, the Act came about. Problems arose when the transitional provisions commencing the Act and deadlines by which unregistered deeds were to be registered before the new Act came into operation were not achieved by some legal practitioners. In order to rectify the situation pursuant to the Act, they would have to make an application for local registration to the Supreme Court. They claimed that this was burdensome and an expense they had not catered for, and that it was unfair. I take this opportunity to advise the House that the Bar Council has been consulted before this bill was presented to Parliament today. The submission received from only two lawyers, advocating a complete overhaul of the land registration system, which has existed in Gibraltar since 1888. The merits and costs of moving away from the current system is something which may be explored as a long-term project. It will take more detailed consideration and was not in our election manifesto. In the meantime, and in the light of the manifesto commitment, the bill contains a main change to deal with the concerns raised by legal practitioners and the Registrar of Land Titles at the time. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to you.
Before I take a question, if any of our members wish to speak on the merits of this bill. I now put a question, which is that a bill for an Act for Amending General Land Title Act 2011 be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Gibraltar Land Title Amendment Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice of the committee stage and third reading of the bill to be taken today if all honourable members agree.
All honourable members agree that the committee stage and third reading of the bill be taken today.
A bill for an Act to make provisions for the voluntary registration of private trust companies and for matters related thereto. The Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I have urged the bill for an Act to make provisions for the voluntary registration of private trust companies and for matters related thereto be read a fourth time. I now put the question, which is that a bill for an Act to make provision for the voluntary registration of private trust companies and for matters related thereto be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Private Trust Companies Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to read the Private Trust Companies Bill 2015 be now read a second time. Mr. Speaker, private trust companies or PTCs may already be established in Gibraltar. Any limited company may act as a trustee provided that does not carry on a licensable activity. Typically, however, such a company will notify the SSC A, that it has been formed to administer a trust company by one or more individuals, B, that this is its sole purpose, and C, that it will not receive remuneration for providing trusteeship. In order to be able to act as a trustee of any one or more trusts, often the trusts of the family. Speaker, while this provides a simple and cost-effective basis for establishing a PTC, the lack of a formal registration procedure sometimes prevents clients and intermediaries from recommending Gibraltar as an appropriate jurisdiction for the incorporation of a PTC, as there is no legislative or regulatory framework within which the PTC is formally recognised and can operate. Introducing a law to govern the operation of PTCs would provide greater legislative protection and certainty, and encourage potential clients to consider Gibraltar as an attractive jurisdiction in which to establish a PTC structure. At present, Gibraltar is at a disadvantage compared to other international financial centres which have made specific provisions for PTCs in their legislation. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, it's appropriate to report and to mention to the House that the Society of Trust and Estate Practitioners who have been promulgating this legislation together with a series of other bills
which some of us will be considering today from 7 years ago are delighted at the steps that we are taking. There are numerous benefits to appointing the PTC as a trustee of a trust in place of professional individuals or licensed professional trustees. Mr. Speaker, I'm afraid to mention the approach that we have adopted towards implementing this legislation. A mandatory registration regime could be unfairly and unnecessarily onerous, especially on PTCs in respect of which the cost of registration in euro might be disproportionate to the size of the trust fund. We therefore felt that a voluntary system of registration would provide for those who chose to submit to it a legal framework in which a PTC could be officially established and operated, whilst at the same time provide flexibility for those seeking to opt out of it. The legislation therefore fills a gap in Gibraltar's offering as an international finance centre without prejudicing those who may have felt forced by a mandatory system of registration. Notwithstanding the voluntary policy of the PTC, Madam Speaker, the proposed legislation provides for, among other matters, the establishment of a register and for inspection of the register by members of the public, and yet registration in euro to be accompanied by a declaration of compliance. Before I close, I should briefly mention that amendments have been notified to you with the Speaker in writing, and these largely comprise the correction of minor errors and stylistic changes. However, we also decided, after input from the Finance and the Council, that it served no purpose not to include the name and address of the registered administrator in the register, and that information will now have to be fully available to public inspection. Mr. Speaker, the Government is confident that the legislation or proposal will be a great addition to the growth of trust offering, especially but by no means exclusively in the context of family offices. Once again, Mr. Speaker, the Government is indebted to the efforts of those individuals and firms, as well as the committee, joined from the private sector in bringing this bill to fruition. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on general principles and merits of this bill?
Yes, the people will be supporting this bill as it will be supporting the other two bills, which will be taken with effectively as a package to deliver for the financial services industry in various different respects. Some very positive changes and initiatives which many in the industry have agreed for a long time were needed and probably overdue. Certainly, Mr. Speaker, the bill has clearly been drafted in consultation with the relevant stakeholders. And in that regard, having reviewed them, there's nothing really to add to the debate other than to say that we, on this side of the House, welcome the arrival of these initiatives and look forward to benefiting, certainly in the professional context, from the advantages that this will bring in due course.
I will now put a question. Is that a bill for an item?
Sorry.
Mr. Speaker, I also welcome and will be supporting this bill. That is, of course, no surprise, but I do so with a great deal of pleasure because this bill, and as the Honourable Member opposite has mentioned, the two bills that follow, and I won't be making the same speech three times, and the members will be glad to know, the Purpose Trust Bill and the Trust Private International Bill are good for business, good for the industry, and generally good for the voter. They have been much awaited and are needed tools to increase the range of products and harmony that professionals in the voter have to offer the financial services world. I remember, and the Honourable Member of the State has mentioned discussing the steps congregating these measures as far back as 7 years ago. And I certainly remember being inside a practice and having discussions with colleagues of my family and elsewhere about the need to include this type of legislation to the financial services offering that we already have in Gibraltar. started work when I was Minister for Financial Services in this area. And I'm very glad to see that my learned, honourable colleague took over that work, and this has been fruitful during this term of office. Gibraltar, primarily, as we all know, Mr. Speaker, is a services jurisdiction. That is primarily what we do, we offer services. We have a competitive world out there, and the greater the range of products, the greater the range of schools that we have in Gibraltar, the greater our competitive edge. And we are required to remain at the top of our game, and for our professionals to remain at the top of their game by having them to be true. And that is what we in government are required to do, to facilitate that work, to work in partnership with the private sector, to provide the tools that are necessary, to promote the work of the industry, and thereby to improve the offering of Gibraltar. That is how Gibraltar moves on. That is why we've got the resources we have in the finance department with the senior executives who go round and in bigger conferences and talk about what we do in Gibraltar. And it is important that we come to this house and we announce these pieces of legislation so that message gets out there and that Gibraltar continues to be recognized as the first class jurisdiction that we all recognize that we are and that we will continue to be for many years. Thank you.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to make provision for voluntary registration of private trust companies and for market presenters there to be heard a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried. The Private Trust Companies Act 2015. Mr. Speaker, I'd like to notice that the committee says important that the bill be taken today for all honourable members agree. Honourable members agree that the committee states and third reading of the bill be taken today. A bill for an act to make provisions to allow the trust for a purpose or purposes otherwise than for practical purposes and for matters related thereto. The Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to make provisions to allow the trust for a purpose or purposes otherwise than for charitable purposes and for matters related thereto be read a first time.
I now put the question, which is that a bill for an act to make provisions to allow the trust for the purpose or purposes otherwise and for charitable purposes and for matters related thereto be read a first time. Is in favour? As again carried.
For purpose trust act.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the purpose trust bill 2015 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, ordinarily a trust will contain identified or identifiable beneficiaries, and the duties imposed upon trustees are owed to those beneficiaries. Charitable trusts established for one or more charitable purposes are a long held exception to this principle. With regard to non charitable purposes, however, the law has been slow to recognize that trusts have a role to play. A number of finance centers, therefore, have taken steps in the legislation permitting the creation and enforcement of trusts whereby the trustees hold property and trust to carry out specific purposes which do not qualify as charitable. This type of trust is usually referred to simply as a purpose trust. The British Parliament will add Gibraltar to that list of jurisdictions, which includes Jersey, Guernsey, and the Cayman Islands. Mr. Speaker, there are a number of purposes which are purpose trust would be useful, which include to fill the charity gap, that is to say, to enable purposes which cannot strictly be said to be charitable, but which equally do not require beneficiaries, for example, a request for the trust fund to be used for the promotion of peaceful relations between nations, to maintain control over family assets, such as when there is an aim to benefit family, but also to ensure the continuance of the business. A purpose trust might make certain that the business is retained without interference from the beneficiary, and the beneficiary could still receive dividends from the business without right to interfere. Mr. Speaker, you will see that the bill has been carefully designed so as to ensure that, among other things, a purpose trust established in Gibraltar has purposes that are capable of being carried out and are sufficiently certain to be capable of being carried out. We have also made certain that at least one trustee or purpose trust
must be a licensed trustee. This bill also sets out particular powers that a trustee will need in the context of a corporate trust, such as, for example, the discretion to formulate the lien by which to give effect to the purpose of the trust. Finally, the bill also provides verifications to court by the trustees and other authorized parties, disapplies the rule against perpetuities in commonwealth jurisdictions that have adopted corporate trust legislation, and also creates various offences for breaching various provisions of the Act. Mr. Speaker, this bill is another example of how government is ensuring the continued growth and success, not just of the trust industry and the financial services industry. As with the trust firewall legislation and the private trust company legislation, I want to record my gratitude to the Private Sector Committee and those personally involved in drafting this legislation for their work in bringing this to the House. Mr. Speaker, I commend the bill to the House.
Before I put a question to any other members to speak on the same principles and merits of this bill, I now put the question, which is that the bill for an act to make provision to allow for trust for the purpose or purposes otherwise than for charitable purposes, and for matters related thereto, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The purpose trusts. Mr. Speaker, I beg you to give notice of the committee third and third reading of the bill taken today for honourable members to go.
Do all the honourable members agree with the committee third and third reading of the bill taken today?
A bill for an act to provide for certain matters of private international law in relation to devoted trusts and for connected purposes. The Honourable Minister for Financial Services and Gaming.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that a bill for an act to provide for certain matters of private international law in relation to devoted trusts and for connected purposes be read a fourth time.
I now put a question, which is that a bill for an act to provide for certain matters of private international law in relation to devoted trusts and for connected purposes be read a first time. Those in favour? Those against? Carried.
The Trust Private International Law Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the Trust Private International Law Bill 2015 be read a second time. Mr. Speaker, the trust industry worldwide is a large, mature, and increasingly competitive one. In this marketplace, many jurisdictions have enacted so-called firewall legislation designed to attract substantial investments and deposits of trust funds by providing a secure environment in which local law trusts are free from attack by foreign laws and foreign courts. Typically, firewall legislation does two things. Firstly, it sets out rules that limit the circumstances under which any foreign law can affect a local law trust, and secondly, prevents the enforcement of foreign judgments that undermine these principles. The Cayman Islands is the first major finance center to enact this legislation in 1987 and remains a global leader in this field. In response, other centers have reformed their laws, and many have since extended the scope of our firewall legislation beyond that of the Cayman Islands. For instance, Jersey has amended its trust law several times in recent years, Guernsey and Cyprus have also amended their legislation. Each successive amendment in each jurisdiction goes further than the last in the quest to provide world-leading protection. In the bill before you, I believe we have struck the right balance between, on the one hand, too little protection, such that the legislation is unlikely to prove attractive in the global marketplace and is unlikely to attract meaningful investment, and on the other hand, Mr. Speaker, so much protection that we would risk being perceived as a haven for fear-driven assets. It will, of course, be appreciated by the Gibraltar position is unique. We are bound by EU regulations in the field of private international law. In particular, we are bound to recognize and enforce judgments from fellow EU member states pursuant to regulation EC number 44/2001 and EC number 4/2009. Moreover, Gibraltar's position differs again from, for example, the Cayman Islands and Cyprus, and the provisions of the Hague Convention on the law applicable to trust and their recognition apply in Gibraltar. The Hague Trust Convention also applies in many other finance centers, including Jersey and Guernsey. The convention states that the law chosen by a settler applies to almost all issues relating to the trust once created, but does not apply to preliminary issues necessary for the creation of the trust. Importantly, the convention also contains a number of exceptions in favor of rules of the legal system
designed by Gibraltar's choice of law rules for related areas of law, such as divorce and matrimonial property, which cannot be derogated from by voluntary act. Mr. Speaker, the legislation assembly of citizens which is purported simply to exclude the possibility of any derogation to foreign law is not one that Gibraltar could or would want to follow, and we are making it clear in this bill that our legislation is subject to the provisions of the Hague Trust Convention, as enacted by the Trust Recognition Act of 1989 and, of course, to EU law. Mr. Speaker, besides providing for the very circumstances in which the Gibraltar Court had jurisdiction in relation to trusts, this bill sets out in clause 4 when various questions relating to Gibraltar Trust are to be determined by Gibraltar law alone, subject, again, of course, to the Convention. Moreover, the bill provides for the regulation of foreign law on foreign judgment orders and decisions in relation to Gibraltar Trust, and when foreign trust must be regarded as being governed by and interpreted according to its proper law. Mr. Speaker, this bill is another milestone in this government's plan to strengthen Gibraltar as a finance centre. And I again, Mr. Speaker, for the third time today, want to acknowledge the great work of the Private Sector Committee that has been advising government on this and the other piece of legislation referred to earlier. Mr. Speaker, I commend this bill to the House.
Before I put the question, does any honourable member wish to speak on the general principles and merits of this bill? I now put the question, which is a bill for an act to provide for certain matters of private international law in relation to the Gibraltar Trust and for connected purposes, be read a second time. Those in favour? Those again? Carried.
The Trust Private International Law Act 2015.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to give notice that the committee chair and third reading of this bill be taken today if all honourable members agree.
Can all members agree that the committee chair and third reading of the bill be taken today?
Committee stage and third reading, the Honourable the Chief Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honour to move that the House would resolve itself into committee to consider the following bills called by board. The Appropriation Bill 2015, the Gibraltar Land Titles Amendment Bill 2015, the Supreme Court Amendment Bill 2015, the Fair Trading Bill 2015, the Private Trust Company Bill 2015, the Purpose Trust Bill 2015, and the Trust Foreign International Law Bill 2015.
A bill for an act to appropriate sums of money to the service of the year ending on the 31st day of March 2016 and further sums of money to the service of the year ended 31st day of March 2014. Clause 1.
Strong part of the bill. Mr. Speaker, I circulated to honourable members, I think they received, a notice of amendment which I'm advised by the Financial Secretary who is in the House, the President, Mr. Bennett, the first time he's in the House with the government, and I'm sure all will want to welcome him to fight. Despite the press releases which will be related to his appointment, and the amendment, if you speak it, relates to typographical errors which have crept into the book. I think we have given members the amendment with the markup so that they can spot it. Some very minor amendments, but when they are followed through in the rest of the whole of the book. So if something is wrong, if something is improperly described, then that description has to go through in the book. And then there are one or two at the end which I'll bring members to when we get to them, where the complement is wrong in two areas. The vote of for the complement is correct, so the sum don't change. The number that has been put in has put in as a typographic error. figure whenever you want to do it. There isn't anything to move and close one. Oh, you've moved close one already, the standard part of the day, and there's nothing to move now for some time. If I formally move that these amendments be incorporated, these paragraphs will always be incorporated in the draft. I think it will be easier for everyone.
Unless any honourable member wishes to raise any matter or has any problem with any of these amendments, they have been circulated, they are fairly clear cut. I move that the committee agree that they be incorporated as appropriate. Those two, head one, treasury, subhead one, payroll, subhead two, other charges. Head two, six, common pay, subhead one, payroll. Subhead to other charges. Head three, customs, subhead one, payroll.
You're indulged, Mr. Chairman, sorry, I beg your pardon. For your indulgence, go to head and page 27, subhead 21, advertising and official notices. What I notice from the figures you provided is the forecast outcome for 2014-2015 is 1,280,000 from an estimate for £500,000. Given that the estimate is in excess of a substantial amount of money, can we go and provide an explanation for the doubling of the focus item? Page 27, item 21. 27, item 21. Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. What is the figure? This figure is every year an estimate because we don't know how much advertising or how many official notices have to be put. There may be more traffic works, there may be less traffic works, there may be more advertising or less advertising. So it's because of that. This is to an extent demand driven. It depends what is happening and what we're advertising.
Head three, captain, subhead one, payroll, subhead two, other charges.
Head three, customs, start following.
Head three, group captain, subhead one, payroll, subhead two, other charges.
Head for broadcasting, stand part of the group.
Head 5, income tax, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Head 5, income tax, stand part of the bill.
Head 6, parliament, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Head 6, parliament, stand part of the bill.
Head 7, human resources, subhead 1, payroll. Subhead 2, other charges. health, and health care and human resources come part of the bill.
Head aid, immigration and civil status, Subhead 1 payroll, Subhead 2 other charges.
Head 8, immigration and civil status, stand part of the bill.
Head 9, financial secretary's office, Subhead 1 payroll, Subhead 2 other charges.
Mr. Chairman, could I ask the going for the next? I think it was not the next. The comment. It's on page 42, item 2.3, the comment. If this is £183,000, that's the correct figure for the estimate. Is it correct? And could you go on and therefore provide an explanation? Sorry, because the evidence is this is the salary for the financial secretary on the government, Mr. Speaker.
Head 9, financial secretary's office, and part of the bill.
Head 10, procurement office, Subhead 1, payroll. Subhead 2, other charges.
Head 10, procurement office, stand part of the bill.
Head 11, civil aviation, Subhead 1, payroll. Subhead 2, other charges.
Head 11, civil aviation, stand part of the bill.
Head 12, town planning and building control, Subhead 1, payroll, Subhead 2, other charges.
Head 12, town planning and building control, one part of the bill.
Head 13, tariff, Subhead 1, payroll. Subhead 2, other charges.
Head 13, health, stand part of the bill.
Head 14, environment, Subhead 1, payroll, Subhead 2, other charges.
And can you actually go back on payroll, if I may? In relation to one in salary, I noticed, Mr. Chairman, that there was an estimate of £900,000 estimated for 2014-2015, and we have a focus outcome of £780,000. Can we have an explanation as to why it was estimated in relation to the complement figures of the department, and why the drop? Because I noticed that the estimate for this new financial year is even slightly less than the complement, or rather, than the focus outcome. So what I'm seeing here is a picture between the estimate of 2014-2015 in comparison to the new estimate, it's quite a significant drop. And that must be one way or another reflect the establishment figure. So could I have an explanation for that?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that this is because at the time there may have been a move between, and we're talking about back in 2015, a move between departments.
Seems to be establishing figures on page 51. And I don't know whether this is helpful or not, but I noticed that under the Department of Environment, there had been a movement of personnel. For instance, environmental monitors, which were in the treatment of the thing, in this year it's not. But then if we go to the next page, on page 52, we see the movement reflected there, and also with the Environmental Protection Officer. But I am really assuming a lot of things here, and this is why I'm really asking the question to get some details.
Chairman, I'm not concerned about the slight drop between last year and this. This is nothing major. But I do believe, and I would need to go back, that it may be that in 2015, I think for a while, the one of the
in fact, whilst the Honourable Minister, I think if you look at the section of the summary,
and I just said that they have kindly assisted, I was thinking of a previous year in which we had some area which was environment were passed, first of all, to my colleague, and then they come back. But if you look at payroll, what essentially has happened is that from the Department of the Environment, they've been moved and now entered, instead of being scattered between Department of the Environment and supernumeraries, they've now been entered as a cleansing section. And if you go down to cleansing section, there is now an element there of salaries which adds that to the 740, the 186, and that balances out approximately the figure that we're looking at. So it now appears under cleansing section rather than as Department of the Environment. If you look at M, it's zero for last year and 186 for this year. Yeah? Yeah. And we're all some change, but I thank the financial services for the assistance,
Mr. Chairman. Page 14, environment, stand part of the bill.
However, just we move on from the actual head itself, there's a couple of other points which I would like to raise. Things are essentially going too fast, and I need some space as well as time to actually look at some of the details here. One of the things I would like to raise for an explanation is the Honourable Member goes to page 55, item 2C, under the title of Air Quality Monitoring Environmental Agency. What I'm noticing is a slight decrease between the estimates of last year and this year. I'm just wondering whether, as a result of the contract in existence for the services of air quality monitoring, there is a reason why that range of services is being limited or is becoming less and less. I mean, why is the explanation of
a number of what is paid for from that head are contractual with external contractors, and others are certain local things that we do, certain work and certain equipment, and the department this year believes that we don't have to have the expenditure that we had last year, but it doesn't mean that there's going to be any less air monitoring. It's just that we spent a bit more last year than this year because we reckon we don't need to repeat every year.
But is it not the case that the Honourable Minister did allude to the fact that there was a need to increase the services in terms of air monitoring as a result of new circumstances? And I would have assumed that that is the case, and there is a need to increase the different type of air monitoring. I would at least expected that the size of the contour will remain the same, or is not even increased.
Mr. Chairman, the staff of the Financial Secretary has kindly confirmed that what I alluded to earlier was correct, that we did buy certain equipment last year, and therefore we don't have to buy it this year. So what I said in my budget speech that we were considering, we are now at the point of revising the contract, which is now due for renewal with the UK consultant. We are revising to see how we are going to be sending the monitoring. Now, this may mean
that we deploy the existing monitors in different locations rather than getting new monitors. That is a process that we're going through now. So it may not be necessary to buy any more additional equipment. If that is the case, then clearly we would need to see how we fund that. But that is going to take a while to review. But the drop here that the Honourable Member mentioned earlier is, I can confirm, due to the fact that we bought equipment last year, we don't need to buy it again this year. It's got a lifespan, and therefore there's no need to have that spending.
I'm grateful, Mr. Chairman. Moving to item 2G, Annual Welfare and Conservation, Annual Welfare Centre. We have an estimate of £95,000 for the last financial year, 2014-2015, and the focus item is more or less that low, but then this has jumped up to £150,000. Can the Honourable Minister provide an explanation of the reason for that?
Most certainly, the Animal Welfare Centre is assisting in the provision of personnel for the increased management regime in the Upper Rock, which we have seen increase this year, and that is what is reflected there.
And lastly, in this section of page 14, item 4. Of Commonwealth Park. We had an estimate of £100,000 for the financial year 2014-2015 and a focus item of £250,000. Can the Minister provide some information as to this over expenditure?
It's for the car park, Mr. Speaker.
Started to do.
Yes, absolutely. Remember, Mr. Chairman, that last year was the initial year of the management contract, and therefore there's always an additional amount of equipment and so on to start up any new management program. That is, again, not going to be necessary with that extent. And in any case, Mr. Chairman, he will have seen a slight increase in the upkeep of planted areas. So if we were to find that there was any shortfall as a result, then we do have flexibility there. But essentially, it's due to the fact that a lot of the initial equipment that had to be bought, lawnmowers, biking machines, and so on, do not have to be bought other than in the first year.
And the Minister can confirm that that's the same towards equipment?
Not exclusively towards equipment, but partly towards equipment and security, the whole management of Commonwealth Park, but the start-up expenses are greater than the running expenses.
Mr. Chairman, the point I'm alluding to, the point I'm getting to is whether it's actually whether any of that, any element of that was in addition to the contractual arrangements with wildlife, or whether this is exclusively for equipment and other needs that were required at the park, rather than as an additional contribution to the contractual payment that is already agreed and made and paid to wildlife.
This is the whole budget for Commonwealth Park, so it is likely that there will have been a bit of both.
And therefore there will have been an additional payment to wildlife as part of that?
No, it's not necessarily. It depends on whether the equipment was bought through the management company, which sometimes happens in contracts, or bought directly by the department. Essentially, it's cost only. It's not that there's a profit element or anything like that. But partly it depends on whether particular items were bought directly or not.
I wonder whether the information is available to perhaps the financial sector.
I don't have a breakdown of exactly what was brought. This is something that we're looking retrospectively, so it's something that that I can either be asking correspondence or in a question in the House to what was said. We believe that the running cost this year, because it's not the start-up year, will be lower and closer to the 100,000. And we're also changing some of the security arrangements and so on, so we believe that it will be closer to 100,000. But any breakdown as to last year, I can obviously provide that information, because that is my mistake.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I've just thought that another item which is very close to my heart, much to the discomfort of the Chief Minister. In relation to item 2H, control figures, gone. What I've noticed is that we've gone, as I said, and did in my budget speech, we've gone from making a payment in 2012-2013 of, I think it was either £84,005 or £85,005, I think it was £84,000, to £230,000. Roughly speaking, is an increase of 270%. And although I've been highly critical for not having any sense of value for money, because they're currently less people now than we used to do long before the termination of the Terra contract, we're doing less now for much more money. That's what we're doing. And while the citizens think this is funny, I think that you're talking about taxpayers' money here, not his money, my money, you're talking about taxpayers' money. And I think I am entitled to ask whether he likes it or not, and can't get on with my comment. Thank you very much. Thank you. Can I have your permission, therefore? Well, I didn't finish my point. Yeah. Exactly, because I'm trying to finish my point, but your colleagues are not allowing me to finish. The point I'm trying to find out is whether this increase in expenditure reflects perhaps an increase in personnel, hopefully, to do a much better service than the one we've had in the last few years.
Firstly, I'd like to say that I'm taking the benefit of using the Chief Minister's Council, the Honourable Joe Bassano, QCCC, who is not in favour of my killing any more guys. I have to recognise that. And now that he's QCCC, I have to take listen to him a lot more even than I used to be. There's a very clear explanation to both things, Mr. Chairman. There is an increase. This is largely to do with equipment. The time has come to purchase new equipment, which includes rifles, and there has been an increase in the complement. But I think I do have to point out, because the Honourable Member has referred several times to the contract with Sarah, and he said so yesterday in his address. The contract with Sarah was not terminated by me. In fact, it ran into 2012 and then expired, and we agreed to hold it, that there had been a certain amount of success and there was no need to repeat it the following year, but we continue in contact and we may think about how we use the services next in future years. But one thing I have to make very clear is that what was not revealed in Parliament the other day is that the cost of FERA was at least, I don't have the figures, it was at about 120 something thousand pounds for a 6 week period when people would come over for 6 weeks, approximately cost £20,000 a week, whereas the money is now going to create employment for 4 or 5 devotees all year round.
Well, Mr. Speaker, and that is not an explanation that explains the reason. That is not an explanation that explains the reason for the increase. The fact of the matter is that the only thing that seems to say that the increase is largely based on the fact that we have to buy new rifles. Well,
Are we going to have a situation where new rifles are going to be bought every year? I mean,
no, not necessarily. I don't keep a personal tag anymore. I used to when I used to be more closely involved in another occupation. But I don't keep a close tag personally on when each item of equipment needs to be renewed, clearly. If I had to keep tabs on each item of equipment, I'd probably keep tabs more on equipment in the hospital than on Valkyrie equipment. But I don't have, no, of course, provided the wear and tear. The more figures you kill, with apology of the Honourable Dover Sam, the more figures you kill, the more you use the rifle, the quicker the wear and tear, and the more quickly you have to replace it. So, I don't know whether the point that the member is saying is that we should actually decrease the money so that we have a less active Gal unit, although he's over time been accusing me of not doing that. There we are, one or the other. I would have thought he would have worked on that.
Page 14, environment, stand for living. Page 15, utilities, covered one, payroll, covered two, other charges. Head 15, utility, stand part of the bill. Head 16, collection and disposal of refuse. Subhead 1, payroll. Subhead 2, other charges. Head 16, collection and disposal of refuse. Stand part of the bill. Page 17, Gibraltar Health Authority, Elderly Residential Services Section, Subhead 1, Payroll, Subhead 2, Other Charges. Page 17, Gibraltar Health Authority, Elderly Residential Services Section, Subhead part of the bill. Page 18, Equality and Social Services, Subhead 1, Payroll, Subhead 2, Other Charges.
Could I have an explanation if I can take the Honourable Lady to page 64, item 2DA, contribution from revenues received? I mean, if I look at all the other columns right now, I feel like the figures almost are the same, meaning the actual 2013-14 is 1,180,000, the estimate for 2014-15 is 1,120,000, the purchase item for 2014-15 is 1,120,000, and then you should drop for the estimate and drop out. There must be a simple explanation for this, and if the Honourable Lady or perhaps Bill could provide that, I would be grateful.
Mr. Chairman, you may have realised that the previous heading just approved was for elderly residential services, which means that the money has been extracted from here and transferred to Head 17, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Equality and Social Services, some part of the bill. Head 19, Tourism, Subhead 1, Payroll. Subhead 2, other charges. Item 19. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to refer to 23A under marketing, promotions, and conferences. There's an increase of about £610,000 from the estimated figure to the forecast item, and then it goes down to £900,000. So it seems like going forward, the standard figure that we see of £900,000 will prevail. Can you explain why there's a blip upwards of £610,000?
Mr. Chairman, for additional marketing, particularly in relation to the new airline route. Mr. Chairman, which would have flown to any airport or terminal, as long as they can land on the runway, Mr. Chairman. Last time I checked, people don't go on holiday to check the airport terminal, Mr. Chairman, they go to visit the destination. And Mr. Chairman, generally it's in relation to an increase in marketing. There's also a payment in relation to the School of Hospitality and that work that the Tourist Board is doing in connection with the university as well.
But 19 tourism stands out of the bill.
Had 20 housing administration, subhead one payroll, subhead two other charges. Is a name, Mr. Chairman, in head 22A and housing legal expenses. I see that the focus outcome for 2014-15 got up to 45,000, given that the estimate is reverting back to 12,000, must have been because of some particular one-off expense. I do know, Mr. Chairman, it could help the Honourable Minister. I do know that I asked during the course of the year on a couple of occasions what there were. Expenses, legal expenses have been incurred in moving courts of other homes and so on. And from the answers I got, it was a figure much, much lower than the 33,000 overspent. So perhaps the Honourable Lady has some sort of information available that can show to us why, you know, this figure went up by well over £30,000.
So we've had, as you know, a change of minister after the end of the last financial year. I know that friends from the Treasury will be able to help, but Ryan isn't here, who was the minister at the time, might be able to shed some light. From memory, the decanting is done on the basis of a retainment, so I don't think it's that. There's a fixed fee element, I think, for the decanting, etc. So this would be an extraordinary expenditure. But this is where we can find the bill. Can I invite the Honourable Gentleman to that we should continue until we either find the bill or we are able to get the information perhaps from the principal or from Jerry Redding or something?
Mr. Chairman, I'm informed that we've had a higher number of a high volume of cases which required legal representation in the last year.
Yes, perhaps I might be right to have closer the question because I understand the minister said we probably have also a higher number of cases. What And so we confirm that these are not in relation to removal of quarters, which is what I have been asking for, but rather could it be connected with the unpaid rent or something like that? Does it have an indication? Or if it doesn't, I think that the next question I can pose the question, whatever is possible, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman, sometimes cases are referred for legal advice and not necessarily end up in litigation, so it may have been cases beyond a victim of squatters or beyond a victim. I have myself asked for advice, I've asked for clarification, I've also asked for an opinion on the Act. So it may be that we're being a little bit more proactive in terms of obtaining legal advice before we actually take steps. And I have noticed that there's been an increase in cases for eviction, but in most cases, I seek advice in advance of the eviction. So that it means that more referrals are made for legal advice.
Yeah, I'm grateful right now as a feedback by Mr. Chairman, and obviously, if you do require something further, you need to be able to obtain guidance from the chair and from the board for the future questions.
Page 21, technical services, chapter 1, payroll, chapter 2, other charges.
Page 21, technical services, time part of the bill.
Page 22, driver and vehicle licensing, subject 1, payroll, 2, other charges.
Page 22, driver and vehicle licensing, stamp part of the bill.
Page 23, court, subject 1, payroll, subject 2, other charges.
Page 22, port, stand part of the bill.
Page 24, economic development, subject 1, payroll, subject 2, other charges.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, with some trepidation, I'm going to make a comment and suggest an answer, and maybe the Honourable Minister can confirm it, in relation to the establishment, where we see a significant decrease overall. Presumably, is that because of the change in responsibilities in this department?
The people who have disappeared have taken the work and the money. The people that work and the money have all moved to it. The people, the work, and the money. So it's now under my colleague. So he's got the people, he's got the work, and he's got the money.
Page 24, economic development, some part of the case. Some part of the bid.
Page 25, statistics office, chapter 1 payroll, chapter 2 other charges.
If I may, this would be a question for Mr. Bafan, Minister Bafan, in relation to Health 24. Can I go back? With your permission. It's page 87, subparagraph 7, which deals with services provided by Gibraltar General Support Services Limited. And before it used to be under the environment. Why can you explain that now under his department, under economic development?
The chairman, it hasn't come now under me. It came under me a year ago, and he voted in favor. If he looks back, it was under the environment in 1314, okay? And these two entities are the entities that were originally created for people to be on the basis that eventually they would be deployed to permanent jobs within the public service. And I am making sure that any changes is only in one direction, which is down and not up.
Head 26, business, employment, and social security, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Chairman, if I can draw the attention of the Honourable Minister for Employment, we're talking about payroll here. Talking about employment, and more specifically on the question of the health and safety officers. If we look at page 92 on the establishment figures, we have health and safety officer 3, which is 1, and health and safety officer 4, which is 2. Can I first of all ask whether, because of course, is there representative of the establishment figures, regardless of the fact whether someone is in post or not in post? So therefore, my first question is whether everyone is in post, or in other words, whether we have to have 2 health and safety officers, 4, whilst 1 could be acting on the higher post, or 3, or is it that we have to have 2, 3, and 1, 4? I mean, can I have an explanation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to answer the question of the Honourable, the questions from Treasury have confirmed my recollection, which is that there is the principal health and safety officer, as you know, from the course of the budget debate, that's vacant. And of the 2 positions in the health and safety officer, 4, one of them is vacant.
Okay, so at the moment, what we have basically 2 factory inspectors. But how do we reconcile that with the Honourable Minister's statement yesterday, when he said when he actually said there were 5 factory inspectors employed? I mean, have I misunderstood the Honourable Gentleman?
Mr. Speaker, I said that there were 4 operational officers and 1 administrative officer, but in any case, as I explained to him, the vacancy for the health and safety principal officer is vacant, and the health and safety officers underneath will now apply for that post, and one of them may or may not be successful, and depending on that, we may have to then go down the chain, which is why the position is coming to as it is. The position of the principal health and safety officer is a position that is filled by the PSC, so it is in that hands to fill that post.
Mr. Chairman, I can understand the logic of that the higher post will have to go out, people will apply, and if someone's successful, they will go into a particular post, and if nobody's successful, by the board, then we will go outside. All that I do understand, but what I want to reconcile in my mind, at the moment, according to the figures presented here, we've got 2. While the Honourable Gentleman is saying there are 4. I'm removing from the equation the administrative officer. I'm talking about the health and safety. You can call it factory inspector, you can call it if you like,
health and safety advisors. Sometimes we've been talking different words. But at the moment, under the establishment figures, it's only two, while the Honourable Gentleman is saying four. Is this, and I'm making here an assumption, this is why I want to clarify the matter, is this because the original health and safety advisors that used to belong what is now the housing agency, before that building from work, probably 3 years ago, was seconded to under the factory's unit, and maybe those two figures can be a different head. But at the moment, I'm trying to reconcile having two figures here with the statement that I saw, but I need to try and square the circle.
Mr. Chairman, just to add to what I have already said, two of the health and safety inspectors are DDC.
What I've always said from the beginning. We don't have four factory inspectors, we have two factory inspectors, of which, in addition to that, we have two members seconded from the housing agency to form part of this group, which must be somewhere in this group.
Mr. Chairman, it has nothing to do with the housing or the secondment. It's just that there are people who are qualified and doing the work of factory inspectors, but are DDC equivalent days, but not the fact that it's not so there is because the DDC grades are so collectively. And the DDC, if you're not a member, you can get what's out that there is at the back of the book. The DDC is not going to have much time left before it is up for the house to work it out. They were the ones who put it there in the first place when they decided that in order to make everything more transparent, the GDC complement would then be broken down saying what everybody voted. So it's in the green pages, and on top of that, if you look at the outcome from the preceding year when they were mine, you will find that there is a block number for the GDC in head 24, okay, which shows 45. And this year it's 17. In the 45 were the people who were health and safety inspectors, which are no longer with me. Part of the reason why we've gone down from 45 to 17 is that not just in the civil service, but in the non-civil service grade, there's also been a separation of function, personnel, and cash.
And Mr. Chairman, to add to what the Honourable Minister Bosano has very eloquently explained, if the Honourable Minister cares to hear the answer and not just ask questions that he thinks is going to embarrass him, but if he wants to confirm our position, he will have read, if he had bothered to read the book when he got it, that at page 93, head 26.4, in the Director Development Corporation staff part, there are 26 GDC. If you add all of it up, we have the answer.
Head 26. Business.
Mr. Chairman. Can I ask? Can I take the minute 12 on page 96? So we have that. Under Industrial Tribunal Reform, £40,000. Can you tell me what that is? Is that exclusively legal fees? Or maybe not at all, actually.
Mr. Chairman, as the only gentleman knows, the Industrial Tribunal Reform is currently taking place, and I've taken it in the past, in respect of the legislative reforms that we're conducting, and which we know that. The £40,000 relates to the amount that may be payable to chairpersons while discharging the function of chairpersons. It's £40,000, it could be less in this financial year, it could be more.
And if I can take him back, just one further point, it's 8F under the Office of Fed, 8F under the Office of Fed Savings, one page back, yeah. And it deals with office rent, parking station service charge of £76,000. Can you tell me why the office is likely to be situated to be clear of an expenditure in relation to these items? It's not a government department or a government premise. Basically the question is where it's going to be situated.
Mr. Speaker, I would be delighted to give the honourable gentleman personally a tour of the new European premises which have been rented for the Office of Fair Trade. I'll even allow him to use one of the parking spaces.
Number 27, Postal Services, Subhead 1, Courier, Subhead 2, Other Charges.
Postal Services, Stand Top of the Bill.
Number 28, Education, Subhead 1, Payroll, Subhead 2, Other Charges.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, on subhead 2H, under the heading of transport of school children, from an estimate of 16,000, we have a forecast out, you know, of 45, which is a substantial increase. And that seems to be an increase in something that somehow or another the Ministry of Education is going to established as well as a more permanent feature, because we're even predicting for this year we just commenced at 55,000. Does anyone member have an indication why we have quadrupled from one year to another, and in respect of what?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this is over expenditure which relates to the hire of additional vehicles to cater for the increase in demand as a result of special educational needs too. And we expect that demand to continue into next year.
Yeah, great for that one, Mr. Chairman. And further down the page on the subsection 12, contract officers, the forecast outcome for our year is 47,000. That expenditure is not only continuing, but is even being increased by an extra 18,000. Is in respect of one officer, more officer, and what sort of contract officer is it that we'll engage?
Mr. Speaker, this is to cover the cost of employed pension contributions, as well as £8,000 provision in relation to a school counselling service for 8 hours a week.
No, sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm not quite saying that something to do with pension contribution doesn't really tally in accounting services as contracted officers. I think the minister just said something about £8,000 a week or whatever for someone. Can you repeat it and clarify for me?
Chairman, I'm informed that it relates to what I have said, and also that there was one individual that was incorrectly charged to salary previously, but it was a contract officer, and therefore should have been charged as contract officer and not to personal emoluments and charges under salaries. Right, so I understand that it has been charged now correctly under contract officer, and it's continuing because it's even receives an increase of an extra £18,000. Which? Sorry? That is why there is the increase.
This year, last year, but the outcome is 47 as opposed to 46, which is almost
all in life, but last year I was 47 here, and an amount in personal emolument. The increase this year is compensated in part by a reduction in personal emolument.
I got the benefit. And which contract office that is it? Is it an educator delivering a service inside the classroom, or is it an administrative post? Do we have an indication of what the duties are in respect to the contract office? Mr. Chairman, the educational psychologist that was previously included, as I understand, as payroll, but it is in fact a contract officer. That's quite grateful for that, Mr. Chairman. Two little chapters further down on relief cover, 22,000. And on the previous page, we do cater already for temporary cover for absences and maternity leave and so on, which I take it to be in respect of the school teachers. So this must be relief cover. Am I correct in assuming for someone other than a school teacher? I mean, what is the case? What, you know, what grade or what relief cover is it a student of? So which particular subhead? There's a standard provision in every head now for relief cover that covers maternity, sickness, and absence in respect of any other grade that is not already covered. So in this case, if the teachers have got their own cover in the complement, this would be a minimum to choose that. No, I follow that. I mean, it was very completely correct the way they explained it, which is why last year and yesterday we put down the token figure of £1,000, and it just so ended up being 22. But this year, instead of putting once again, as we've done in other cases, a token figure of 1,000, we're already predicting exactly the same 22. For example, if we find that there is a token and there are people on long-term sickness or a long-term period of maternity leave, which is known beforehand to overlap the end of the financial year and the beginning, there's not much point in putting a token of £1,000 in April if you know you're going to be spending more than £1,000 in the first month. So where there is a higher sum, it's because there is an ongoing cover at the end of March, normally.
And I'm just taking upon myself, I'm not correct in saying that Minister Osama was able to confirm that this is for police cover other than for classroom teachers, which are covered under another heading.
Okay, sir.
The right to education is some part of the bill. Head 29, policing, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Head 29, policing, stand part of the bill.
Head 30, prison, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Yes, the chairman, on payroll, I note the estimate for 2015-2016 is up by approximately £120,000. And I just wanted to clarify that HUD 37-1 payroll, the main figure, the main estimate, is at page 113. The estimate is at 1786 over the 1594. My query was only whether that I suspect incorporates the estimate for the weekend premium that the Honourable Minister announced during his intervention. Yes, Mr. Chairman, the Honourable, in this is an actual estimate taking into account the complement and what it is expected that they will be paid. There is, as the Honourable Member will see, also an additional amount in respect of overtime, and that was because of the announcement that was made as part of the overall agreement that was made with prison grade, which now includes payment of overtime instead of time off in lieu, which has been historically the case, and as part of the overall package which has been agreed, that has resulted in that amount being the estimate for this year.
Thank you.
30 prisons on parole.
They've had one Gibraltar law court, they've had one payroll, they've had two other charges. Attorney General Stonebridge, subhead one payroll, subhead two other charges.
Head 32, Attorney General Chambers, stand part of the bid.
Head 33, Justice, subhead one payroll, subhead two other charges.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, in relation to Head 33 payroll, I note that there's a new section of probation, a total of £161,000, and obviously if you look at it in terms of the establishment figures as well, it's evident that it's moved into there. Perhaps this is think of whether the Minister can explain why it is that this is happening in this way.
Previously, it used to appear under Social Services, as I recall, and this year it now appears under the Ministry of Justice. It's just a move from one head to another.
I'm grateful for that. It's just that I did look at the establishment figures for Social Services as well, and there doesn't seem to be a corresponding drop in the figures in Social Services this year. That's the only reason I asked that, because I did check it and it didn't pop up. But
I can certainly confirm to the Honourable Member that the probation service did exist before this year, and therefore this is not something new. It was somewhere else, or it must have been somewhere else, and now it is here.
Well, Mr. Speaker, just for the information of the relevant people, then they might just want to look at the figures in social services to see whether they have, you know, let a few people in.
Some part of the book.
Head 34, Fire and Rescue Service, subhead 1 payroll, subhead 2 other charges.
Head 35, Civil Contingency, subhead 1 payroll, subhead 2 other charges. Head 45, Civil Contingency, stand part of the bill.
Head 36, Fourth and Leisure, subhead 1 payroll, subhead 2 other charges.
Chairman, in subhead 1, I note the introduction of the salary of £32,000, which on the previous page in the establishment shows the creation of a new assistant sports performance director. The Honourable Minister made no reference to this particular page, but he did mention some review within the Sports and Leisure Authority. Can you confirm that this post has already been filled, or is going to be filled, and perhaps, you know, a very, very deep insight into what duties someone that is nominated for?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, the Sports Performance Director will be working under the Ministry, not under the GSLA. And therefore, the £32,000 is because we do not envisage the Sports Performance Director to come into play or come into work until September, October, or November. So therefore, it is probably half of what is the salary. It's not a complete year, because by the time that the sports performance officer is in place, there will be we reckon about its calculation of 32. But yes, the person, whoever that person may be, which has to go through the process of the PSC, and all because it would be under the Ministry and not under the Sports and Leisure Authority.
Pardon?
Yes. Yes, like we did with the archaeologists in relation to the heritage. Similar.
And I'm correct in the simple yes from Dennis. Is it premature to ask the minister for some information in respect of the duties, or would you rather that be the subject of the question because it's still under negotiation?
It isn't quite under negotiation, but maybe the person will deal with the things with elite athletes, coordinating all the sports associations in order to help them, and in conjunction with the development unit. So but that person is specifically under the minister.
It's the support and message from part of the bill. 547, culture and heritage, subhead 1, very well, subhead 2, other charges.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, in subhead 29, purchase of cultural items, there have been no provision in the estimate, and they have to undergo an expenditure of 122,000. And therefore, for this year, after the Honourable Chair was kind of reminded all of us, he just leave a token figure of £1,000 in case it happens again. But given a substantial expenditure and something that has not been predicted or asked for in the previous year's estimate, can the Minister enlighten us on the £122,000 expenditure?
Mr. Speaker, most of that was the buying of the limited collection. Which is now in the Mario Finiston National Art Gallery. We had an offer to buy all her collections and all her work, but it is not the full amount. Another bits and pieces that have been bought, like I think there was a Gustavo Adaita that was bought at one point as well. So all these amounts to be 122.
No, so Mr. Chairman, we believe, and I'm really glad to see that we have continued that practice. I was also responsible for acquiring Tango Sao Bacarita. In fact, we even had to go all the way to Sevilla to purchase it. But it does make the vote all the richer, and I'm sure even the Honourable Father of the House will agree that it's money well spent because it's invested there, and it's like a secret piggy bank. There is an art collector somewhere in the world where one day might make a big and great substantial profit. So I'm glad to see that the minister now has managed to convince the leader of the House to invest in artworks.
Mr. Speaker, just to say that at least we've got the head now, because we've never had that head. We've come from another cup, sort of thing. Now it's supposed to be a cultural item, and it's got a token of one back of it. So we've got there. Yeah.
Culture and heritage, and part of the bill. Head 38, youth, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges. Head 38, youth, and part of the bill. Head 39, financial services, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Mr. Speaker, can the Minister, sorry, Mr. Chairman, explain the increase by 4 in the Senior Finance Centre Executive Head and the establishment, and also now that I can just deal with both points, because we've got 2 points. What the subvention to the SSC is about, I think the focus action figure there, 4.78 million, and it goes down to 550,000. Can you give me an explanation as to why the subvention arises on the basis of this year, the first time that there was it?
Just saying the first point, these are the senior executives that we promised to deliver in our manifesto and have been delivered. They're contract officers and they are being transferred into the main complement, so there's some contracts coming up with the same people. There aren't 4 new. There were 4, now there are 3. Plus 2 new sports, I assume that's where the 4 come from. But they're not 4 new people, no. They're not taking another 4. But the same 4 contract officers we're looking at coming through. With respect to the subvention,
Announcement that we made some months back in respect of the new strategy for the Financial Services Commission and our agreement to fund the shortfall in cost of the Financial Commission over a period of time, which we are doing in partnership with industry, because industry and their licensees have had those fees increased so that within a period of time we step out and they continue. As you will know, I'm sure the Finance Centre Council, the Financial Services Commission, and ourselves are working together on a totally new methodology for the charging of licenses during the course of this year, which will come into effect next April when those fees are levied, and which will review totally the manner in which those fees are currently addressed. I can't predict what that outcome will do, but in terms of the numbers, we expect to make this contribution over the next 12 months to the Commission as a shortfall.
Mr. Chairman, what are the terms of the subvention? Is it anticipated that any further subventions will be supplied?
There is a clear budget which we have agreed with them, and we're committing to the extent of that budget. I don't expect any other end, so I don't expect to pay more than that we are voting for.
I don't understand what he means in that respect in terms of the subvention this year being over £1 million. Does that mean, in effect, that there will be a need to continue to pay subvention next year and the year after that, beyond what is being paid this year?
It's a three-year budget in the sense that the funding requirements they had to employ the strengthening of the resources and the expertise that they have been costed over a three-year plan. I think 2 years, because we are committed to funding them for 2 years. This last year we've had in effect for this year and next year, after which we don't expect to be funding them any further, and they'll be spending on their own 2 feet. Does that answer the question?
Partly, Mr. Chairman. Is it anticipated then that at the conclusion of 3 years they'll be spending on their own 2 feet and there will be a return of funds to government from the FSC? Is that
it's not coming back to government, that's why it's a subvention. It's a three-year investment plan that the government has agreed with the Financial Services Commission, at the end of which we fully expect them to be from the licensees in order to meet their own needs.
And finally, Mr. Chairman, is the extent of the commitment to investment of the government three times what's been paid in this financial year?
No, they are different each year, Mr. Chairman.
Different in what way are they going down? Is the figure going to be less than the 560? Is that the expectation?
Well, obviously, as the licensees increase, the government contribution reduces. So, what we've had is in the part of the first year a lower amount, and the year we just passed a higher amount, and then next year a lower amount again, and then zero.
Okay, 39 financial services and part of the group. Head, Wolfie, Gambling Division, Subhead 1, Payway, Subhead 2, other charges.
Mr. Chairman, I'll group the 3 points. And it's basically seeking an explanation for each of the increases in these areas. So, and it's CE, Office Rent and Service Charges, goes from 33 to 57. The other one is conferences, training, and office travel from the estimated figures we've increased to the four consultants from 21 to 37. And then finally, where we see a considerable increase in the contribution to the GDP from the estimated figure to the forecast item, and then going forward. So the estimated figure for 2015 it also goes up. The estimation for those three increases.
Mr. Chairman, in respect of the first one, the office rent, you will recall that the gambling department was within the floor of offices which I shared with the Minister for Education and Justice. They were relocated some months back to the ground floor, the former offices of the Gibraltar Regulatory Authority, and they now have a small unit on the ground floor of the airport. So those are the new arrangements, so there's quite an increased cost
for sharing costs of being with us and doing our own steps. With respect to conduct of training and official travel, there has been a significant increase in travel this past year in relation to the point of consumption tax, and I would expect some of those costs are put into that. We've attended two conferences this year, so that's what was envisaged, but the increase wouldn't be involved too more on the travel and attending those events in London. With respect to the final point, there's one contribution of one extra person from the GBC. Head 40, gambling divisions, and part of the bill. Head 41, maritime services, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Something like I know that on subhead 2A, computer running expenses, there seems to have been quite a substantial expenditure there, which probably don't be considering to have just been necessary last year, because from the estimate of 10,000, which still remains at 10,000, we actually have a forecast outcome of 58,000, but it's down as running expenses rather than purchase of new equipment or whatever. Can the minister enlighten us on how the computer running charges have been so high?
The increase in cost is wrongly charged to the client in capital cost in terms of new IT equipment. So it will not be there next year, hence to drop back to 10 for the forthcoming year in the capital cost.
Okay. But the one maritime services on panel B.
Head 42, Gibraltar Audit Office, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Head 42, Gibraltar Audit Office, on panel B.
Head 43, Gibraltar Regulatory Authority, subhead 1, payroll, subhead 2, other charges.
Head 43, the Board of Regulatory Authorities, and part of the bill.
We now move to clause 3 of the bill. Head 45, contribution to government owned companies. Subhead 1, contribution to government owned companies.
Head 45, contribution to government owned property. Company, contribution to government owned company, stand part of the bill.
Head 46, transfer from government surplus, head 1, payment to social assistance fund, input duty, transfer from government surplus.
Head 46, transfer from government surplus, stand part of the bill.
Head 47, contribution to the Improvement and Development Fund, subhead 1, contribution to the Improvement and Development Fund.
Head 47, contribution to the Improvement and Development Fund, some part of the bill.
Mr. Chairman, I used to have jumped in the game, but I think I might, because we will be coming now into that.
We now move to clause 4, head 48, exceptional expenditure, head 1, Dr. Hiraldi's home inquiry.
Head 38, exceptional expenditure. Stand part of the bill.
We now move to Clause 5, Improvement and Development Fund. Head 101, Works and Equipment. Subhead 1, Works and Equipment.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, on subhead 1, page, contribution to the Volta Electricity Authority. I see an estimate there of £380,000. Could I perhaps ask the Minister, I mean, it must be for the purchase of perhaps some equipment for the power station, or something related to that, and perhaps could the Honourable Gentleman provide some information?
Equipment, particularly work that has a program. And that's the estimate that we have included there. It includes, for example, refurbishment of buildings, vehicles, computer hardware, plant and machinery, that's the test equipment, it's a selection of equipment and work.
We're basically talking about plant equipment, vehicles, that kind of thing. We're not talking about any sort of consultant report or anything of that kind, no?
Not in the document I have here, no. New business and refurbishment, tools, vehicles. Public lighting, distribution network, baseball distribution building, contribution to that. So,
if I can move on, Mr. Speaker, I'm not quite sure whether my honourable colleague got some question, but I certainly have another one. And if I can, I point it out to the honourable gentleman. If I'm talking about topic 1, item Y, government vehicles and plans, there's a provision there of £150,000. My point is not so much about the amount of money for the ongoing provision of vehicles in the current fleet of vehicles. My point is more related to what I have seen from the figures provided by Honourable Gentleman, in fact, I think it was the Honourable Mr. Alban, who is the Minister for Transport, that in relation to the vehicles purchased by the government in the last few years, the last 3.5 years, in relation to the amount of European certification of producing cars, once we sort of remove the G1 and the Tesla, the hybrid cars, the rest of the other vehicles purchased are classified under European label as very excessively polluting, very polluting. And I know that one of the answers that is a reasonable answer for the government to say is because some of the vehicles purchased are for plans in working in a particular construction site, and by the nature of those particular cars are very polluting. But can I ask the Minister that the environmental filter is focused far greater in the need to ensure that as recently as possible when the purchase of cars are made, they are made in a manner which are less contaminating, because from the figures provided for the last few years, they have not been, once you include the ones that said. And it seems to be that something needs to be addressed, and if it can be addressed as reasonably possible,
when it should be done.
Chairman, it's not my head, but the Minister of our line isn't here. But this is part of the strategy that we will be taking forward.
Take 101 work on equipment, some part of the bill.
Head 102 project, subhead 1 road and parking project, subhead 2 relocation costs, subhead 3 reclamation project, subhead 4 other projects, and subhead 5 equity funding.
This is
Mr. Chairman, yes. In relation to equity funding of government owned companies. This is where in the past there's been contributions to Gibraltar Investment Holdings, I understand it, by way of equity funding that has then trickled down to all the other government owned companies. The 40 million actual for 2013-2014 with an estimate of a million for 1,000, I beg your pardon, 2014-15, and the forecast outlay for that year, past year, is zero. As I recall in previous years, I think it's probably, I may be wrong in relation to this, but I've got a recollection that 2012-2013 is about 70 million. So there's always been substantial contributions. There's a zero forecast outlay in 2015, the past year it's gone. Can you explain why?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the initial contribution was partly because of the fact that the company, for a number of years, had loss-making situations which were covered by advances. When the equity was increased, in effect, it meant that the capital came into the company and the company who paid the advance. The provision of 1,000 is to determine whether in the course of the year we want to meet the capital requirement of a company because we think it needs to be done by increasing its capital, or we find that the company's requirements in terms of cash can be met sufficiently by the 25 million we've now put at the beginning of the year. If the honorable member looks back, he finds that we had the practice initially of putting a token, as we do for community care, and then at the end saying the surplus is given. This time what we've done is we've actually put the original £25 million right at the beginning. If we find that as a result of expenditure of the company in care, it looks as if that is not going to be enough, we then decide whether to up the money that is given from the consolidated fund, or we do it by increasing the capital to the equity.
This is the contributions, this is equity, effectively, this is equity funding that is then used in order to fund government projects, correct?
It is used to repair the currency, basically,
which is what we did initially, because in fact, for a number of years, the balances of the companies going to the state were the shares that the government held in DIA were at a level that the accumulated losses would have brought us into an area where the nominal value of shares would no longer have any relation to the reserve of the company because the losses were being covered by advances of cash, not by transfers of cash. In effect, when the big money was transferred after the 2011 election, it was in fact restoring the position of those companies. When we moved, the last time we moved money into increasing the equity was in 1314. That year we put a token amount, but we decided there was no need to make use of it, and this year we put a token amount, and we'll see how the year goes.
the chairman, yes. On subheading 1A1 on tunnels and roads for more funds, I noticed the actual for 2013-2014 was just shy of 7 million, and that the forecast outcome for this year is over 3 million. And the 1 million pound estimate for last year almost looks like it was a token amount given the actual outcome. Is the estimate for next year, and therefore by implication the amount of work remaining on that project, as that figure would suggest, or how far along are we in relationship to that project? Like, that's what I'm getting at in terms of this. The tunnel from roads to north fund, submitting 1A1.
But you see, I had a discussion on the subject with the former leader of the district about discussing these issues behind the speaker's chair. All I would say at this stage, that we are in mitigation in relation to this matter, is that it is the government's intention to complete this project as soon as possible, but the litigation has delayed the attempt to complete the project ourselves because of issues arising in the sector of liability and the walls which we have inspected. The walls that are under the runway now, so we have inspected having more damage than was anticipated. But the work on dewatering, which is a term I use because it is what I'm told, but I have very little technical understanding of what it means, dewatering, is about to start. And that, in any event, as I think I said in my main speech, the work to the south of the runway, in other words, the road that goes down towards the tunnel, and the road that will come through what used to be Devil's Tower Camp, and now the aerial farm, Beachview Terrace site, and leading to a roundabout there, all of that is expected to be completed by the end of August. Because what we haven't wanted is to hand over that estate, and we should be ready by the end of August or September, and then have to go back in with heavy machinery to do work once people are living there, and we assume that principally there's a group of these families with young children, etc., and we want to do as little disrupting of that area, which will be perceived when it's handed over, as possible, if that helps to the gentleman from the side. I'm quite happy to have a further discussion with him later.
In Chapter 4, M, it can't say construction of drawings. It's a token figure there, over £1,000. I wonder whether we can give some sort of explanation as to the need of this particular project, whether we're dealing basically here with the same problem we had in both roads in terms of erosion of soil and this kind of thing. Also, a completely different kind of project whatsoever.
This is really the Minister for Technical Services, so I will try and assist in his actions. There was a study being carried out, and I'm not sure, and it's not one of my other responsibilities. There was a study being carried out to see whether a groin was A, possible because of the depth of water there, and B, whether it will have an effect of increasing the size of the beach. I'm not sure of the outcome, but I think that pending the outcome, a token was provided because it wasn't possible yet to give any details. That is my recollection and my discussion with them.
I'm grateful, Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chairman, for that. Moving on to just a few lines down below from there, item F, Parliament House. Again, with the token figure there of £1,000. What I would like to know is what is envisaged perhaps that would be done in this new financial year, and particularly whether the lift will be done during the course of this financial year.
All that is planned at the moment is the lift is the things that first, but I know that he was poo-pooed the fact that there needs to be consultation and more consultation. I certainly think we should just have the lift. But the Heritage Trust is very keen that we should try and hide the lift and it's in there, but anyway. And of course,
the monument to Pitikahuana, the monument to Hamanetra, and the monument to the Sama, which will use a lot of copper and will be very expensive. But other than that, it's seriously it's for it.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry to agree with the honor to me today. I mean, you know, I can understand people from the heritage position saying, you know, putting this here will detract from the beauty of the building and the facade, but really think that there are ways and means of different types of this which can be actually adding value and beauty to the building itself, if it's done correctly and nicely, and really, we have to do that and move forward. So, if that's done, it would be great.
So, we've got thank you for your support. We are entirely on the same page. I think the only thing we're having is that the Heritage Preference asking for another engagement on this subject, and therefore, you know, if we have said no, he would be attacking me for not consulting them. But I think it is important that we do have that consultation. But more important is that people with disabilities should have access to the building. This is the most important thing in terms of democracy in this country, and they need to have access. I agree it can be done in a very tasteful way. I think that the existing plans are very tasteful. They take the lift off the building. It's a glass structure, and they come in through the window at the end there. And I think it's perfectly acceptable. Then, when you propose that, then the argument is it gets rid of the symmetry. So there are two ways of dealing with it. Either put it up with it because it's important, or we add two lifts, one on one side and one on the other, or at least a glass acting so that we have symmetry back. Look, this has to be resolved, because the important thing is that people who are disabled should not be caught out of this building.
Well, I certainly support and agree wholeheartedly with that statement, Mr. Speaker.
Head 102 project, that part of the bill. Mr. Chairman, there was a similar item, just one more item, which subhead 4, the third page, Commonwealth Park, at page 156. An entry there of £200,000. Now, what I'm trying to get at, because when you were discussing return expenditure under Head 14, Commonwealth Park, the Honourable Minister's reply stated that part of the over expenditure from £100,000 to £250,000 was of the means that to terminate the project had to buy a lot of equipment and machinery and mowers and things of that kind. But I would have thought that then the expenditure would have finished, but there seems to be like every year putting more and more expenditure. Can the minister perhaps provide an explanation for this?
That is for example the payment of some of the last few bills from the construction which haven't passed into the previous year. So it's nothing new. It's just to take care of the tail end of the creation of the park.
That would be the last payment.
Head 102. Close it, stand part of the bill.
We now move to code 6, which is situated at page 145 of the book. And that is head 44, supplementary provision, subhead 1, supplementary funding. Page 145.
Part of the bill.
We now move to clauses 7 and 8, situated starting at page 152. Gibraltar Development Corporation.
Clause 7, Gibraltar Development Corporation. Part of the bill.
We've got Borders and Coast Guard Agency, which is at page 171. Also, 7 and 8 stand part of the bill. It will go to the Gibraltar Health Authority, which is just at page 173.
And there we have Borders and Coast Guard Agency. Any questions? Stand part of the book.
Did you say Borders and Coast Guard Agency?
No questions? Stand part of the book.
Gibraltar Electricity Authority.
Gibraltar Electricity Authority, 2017. No, stand part of the bill.
Gibraltar Health Authority, Elderly Residential Services Section, page 183.
Stand part of the bill.
Care Agency, page 187.
Care Agency, page 187. Stand part of the bill.
Housing Work Agency, at page 193,
Housing Works Agency, stand part of the bill.
Gibraltar Port Authority, at page 196,
there are no bullet.
You see
that? Yes, Gibraltar, Mr. Chairman. I mentioned this in the course of my budget intervention, and it relates to. It's at page 198, and we were seeking an explanation for the increase in 24, which is advertising, marketing, and travel. The estimated figure for assistance was 80,000, and then the actual forecast outing is close to 300,000. So it's quite a significant increase, yeah. But in any event, I think this relates to an increase that we've changed capital in the port. Different people do things in different ways, and I assume that this is the increased activity that we have seen from this capital in the marketing of the port in the time that the port time has been there. I think that is very likely the reason. I'm happy perhaps the former minister for the port can give the sort of finishing on once he's back. I know he's only entertained, I can hear him from him. You can hear the energy and the enthusiasm. The intelligence is coming through.
Gibraltar Sport and Leisure Authority at page 199.
Yes, again, I just need a little bit of clarification on
page 200 under the subparagraph 23, this introduction of Hope Grant as a general heading of £500,000, and what used to come before under subparagraph 24, we had 490,000, almost the same amount, but broken down was already subdivision before. I'm not quoting because the figures seem to be the same, but can you make a point that what he has done is for the amalgamation of the so as to give the committee and give that more freedom sort of to move between those habits with all the pros and cons that there might be. He might want to enlighten me in the philosophy behind that movement.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. In fact, as he rightly says, last year, and I've got the book here from the estimates of last year, it was broken down into four different ones. But as he rightly says, GSAC at one point was probably, because we had last year 150,000 broken down. And therefore, the committee said, well, sometimes we only spend 100 in one section and only 50 in the other. And there were having problems with passing on, through the system, the money from one to the other. So we arranged in GSAC and said, well, if you have a lump sum, you can still have those within, divided into four, say, but we have more flexibility in being able to pass some of the money for some other things. So that is why this year it's in italics, all those broken down, and therefore they will have more leeway in passing, for example, in music sports competition to the sports development project. That's the better one.
That is probably 7 and 8 completed. Clause of 9 to 12. The schedule part 1 to 10. The long title. A bill for an act to amend the Gibraltar Land Titles Act, clauses 1 and 2, the long title, a bill for an act to amend the Supreme Court Act, clause 1,
Mr. Chairman, clause 1, I move an amendment to remove the words the 1st July 2015 and replace those with a day appointed by the government by notice in the Gazette, and different days may be appointed for different purposes.
Do honourable members agree to that amendment?
So clause 1 as amended,
stand part of the bill. Clause 2, stand part of the bill.
The long title,
stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to establish and provide for the functions of the Office of Fair Trading and the Office of Fair Trading Commission. Encourage businesses to comply with consumer law and improve their trading practices. Streamline and simplify the trade licensing system and rename the modernized system as business licensing. Establish enforcement powers for the Business Licensing Authority, being part of the Office of Fair Trading in cases of non-adherence by licensees. Establish a single point of contact as part of the business licensing procedure. Amend the law relating to the protection of the collective interest of consumers, enable action to be taken against conduct which may significantly harm the interests of consumers and for purposes connected therewith.
Part 1.
Part 2.
Stamp.
Part 3.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 4.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 5.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 6.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 7.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 8.
Stamp part of the bill.
Part 9. Clauses 58-72.
These said amendments have been circulated to all honourable members, amending clause 73, becoming 70, 73 and 74 in fact, spoken. So, I put the amendment, do all honourable members agree to the amendment circulated in respect of clause 73? Clause 73 as amended stand part of the bill, and do all honourable members agree to the amendment in respect of clause 74 as circulated? Clause 74 as amended stand part of the bill.
Clauses 75-90,
clause 75-90 stand part of the bill. There is an amendment to clause 91, which measures have been given and has been circulated. Are all honourable members happy with the amendment? Clause 91 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 92-100.
Clause 93-100, stand part of the bill.
Schedules 1-3.
Schedules 1-3, stand part of the bill.
If the honourable minister recalls, I mentioned a point in schedule 2 and then 5 or 3, 5, where there was a reference to subparagraph 5. Has he considered that and would he be considering an amendment? Making sure to clarify that he's referring to the same paragraph.
Yes, Mr. Speaker, if the chairman has considered the proposed amendment proposed by the honourable minister of the and I think that most of the feeling, I thought it was, I would just keep considering a member of the government. And I think that section 3, paragraph 5 reads well the way that it does.
Stand part of the bill.
Schedule 3.
Stand part of the bill.
The long title.
Stand part of the bill.
We now move to a bill for an act to make provisions for the voluntary registration of private trust companies and for matters related thereto. Some amendments have been circulated beforehand.
An amendment, a series of amendments.
We're happy, Mr. Chairman, we're happy to take the amendments that have been already read out to the House.
So, clause 1, stand part of the bill. Clause 2 as amended, two as amended, stand part of the bill. Clause 3 and 4. Clause 3 stand part of the bill. Clause 4. Not agreed to, then. Clause 4 as amended, stand part of the bill. Clause 5 as amended, stand part of the bill.
Clause 6 as amended,
4-6 as a member of the stand part of the bill, 12-7 or 7 stand part of the bill, 12-8 as amended, 12-8 as amended stand part of the bill, 12-9 as amended, 12-9 as amended stand part of the bill, 12-10 as amended, 12-10 as amended stand part of the bill, 12-11 4-11 stand part of the bill, 12-12 as amended stand part of the bill, 12-13 as amended stand part of the bill, 12-14 stand part of the bill, 31 stand part of the bill, 32 as amended stand part of the bill, 33 as amended stand part of the bill, 34 and 5 stand part of the bill, the long title stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to make provisions to allow for trust for a purpose or purposes otherwise than for a trustful purpose, purposes, and for matters related thereto. Part 1. Stand part of the bill. Part 2. Stand part of the bill. Part 3. Stand part of the bill. Part 4. Stand part of the bill. The long title. Stand part of the bill. A bill for an act to provide for certain matters of private international law in relation to devoted trust and for connected purposes. Clauses 1 to 8. Stand part of the bill, the long title. Stand part of the bill. That is courses 1 to 9 stand part of the bill, and the long title of course also stands part of the bill.
Mr. Speaker, I have the honest report that the Appropriation Bill is a both aligned titled amendment bill. The Supreme Court Amendment Bill 2015. The Trading Bill 2015, the Private Trust Companies Bill 2015, the Purpose Trust Bill, and the Trust Private International Law Bill 2015 have been considered in committee and agreed to extend with amendments, and I now move that they be read a third time and passed.
I now put a question, which is that the Appropriation Bill 2015 be what? Be read a third time and passed. Those in favour? Those against?
I think that you do the list, don't you? And you have to do the question. So, because I want a division on the Appropriation Bill.
The Appropriation Bill. We call a division. By Dan P.J. Absent. Bosano J.J. Bosano D.J. Caruana P.R. Absent. Cortez J.E. Costa N.S. Isabel Hammond I.M. Absent. Peter D.A. Fidelis S.M. Gaifura J.J. Isla A.J. Aye. G.H. Maris F.D. Aye. Gaifura F.R. Yes. Gaifura E.J. Aye. Gaifura F.J.
There are three members absent, 13 members have voted in favour, one against, carried.
I thought I had a no. I didn't. So, there are three members of action, although there's 14 in favor. The appropriation bill is approved. I'll put the question that the other one is going to. The Gibraltar Land Title Amendment to 2015 be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
As against? Carried. That the Supreme Court Amendment Bill 2015 be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
That the Fair Trading Bill 2015 be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
That the Private Tax Companies Bill 2015 be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
That the Petrol Trust Bill be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
And that the Private International Law Bill 2015 be read a third time and passed. Those in favor?
Aye.
Mr. Speaker, the debate on the appropriation bill is always a difficult one for every member of the House, to prepare for it intensely. We experience many views, and yet it is now over for another year, and I think we will all be reflective of that and happy with the difficult work of the House that this panel is now over. I thank all members of the Speaker for their contribution. I thank all members for voting in favour of the bill presented by the government in that respect. And I now have the honour to move that the House to now adjourn. Thank you.
And I propose a question that the House will now adjourn immediately. And I now put the question that the House do now adjourn immediately. Those in favour?
Aye.
Those against? Carried. The House will now adjourn immediately.